Welcome to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, and alongside me tonight is my co-host for the second time this week, Andy McNamara. You can follow us on Twitter at MattSN590 and at AndyMC81. Our producer of this fine program is Sho Ali, and keeping us on the air, making sure that we don't swear, making sure that he hits the bleeps whenever he needs to, is our technical operator, Tom Young. And coming up on tonight's program, we're going to talk to Brendan Deeg, National Football Post and co-host of the Double Doink podcast, on what has been a, we'll call it, an interesting day of Thanksgiving Day football down in the United States. 8 o'clock, Sean Woodley of the Locked On Raptors podcast. We're going to play a little Win Andy's Pizza at 8:25. Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic will join us at 9 o'clock to chat some Blue Jays. You're also going to hear a replay of the Honorable David Lametti from Writer's Block on the Canadian government's bill to decriminalize single game betting. And John Chick, NBA writer for The Score, will also be along. And we'll do a little best in show to cap things off for the evening. Andy, my friend, how are you tonight, buddy?
Matty, doing good, man. Doing good. We got all day football. I've had, like, it's been sort of, I've treated it as my own mini American holiday. I had some pizza, some marbled cookie brownie for dessert. I'm feeling fine and full, baby.
Yeah, I did a little Swiss Chalet tonight. Got a little stuffing along with my quarter chicken dinner. So, I try to do my best impression of American Thanksgiving as well. I'm a little bit conflicted, I'm not going to lie, because I really wanted to see the Thursday Nighter, but we're on the air and we probably wouldn't be able to see much of it. So I'm kind of conflicted as to whether I wanted this game to go on or not tonight.
Right. And heck, if things keep testing the way they are in Baltimore, we might not see this thing on Sunday either between the Ravens and the Steelers. So that's the big question. Yeah, Larry, we heard in the update there, Larry Fitzgerald is tested positive. It is, Matt, I just kind of feel we're at the point of the season, the byes finish up next week, and it's just kind of like, hold on tight and let's just get through this season. Like, just get through it. I think that's the NFL's attitude too.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. We're at a point now where it's do whatever we can to get the games in.
Yep.
Because we know that the most important thing, whether we have fans in the stands or not, is to have the Super Bowl. That is the that is the end game here, because that's the big money maker. So it's really, really important for that to get done. So we'll get to our show question for the night, but I wanted to ask you about American Thanksgiving, because I'm really jealous of the way that they do it. Like, they do it on the Thursday, take the Friday off, and then they have the 4-day weekend. Like, they really do Thanksgiving right. We kind of screwed the pooch on that one, but in terms of just overall, like, the American Thanksgiving tradition, what is your favorite part about it? Is it the Black Friday deals, or is it the all-day football on Thursday?
Oof, no doubt all-day football. No doubt the all-day football. Because for a long time, Matt, like, at least for me, like, I'm 39, so for most of the time, up until recently, like, we didn't have the access. Like, when I was, you know, teenager and stuff like that, there wasn't the Black Friday deals up here. It was like, you saw the cool commercials, and you're like, oh, everything's still regular price here. And now everything's online, and you can do, you know, now you take advantage of it. So for me, maybe it's just like based on longevity, like it's just the all-day football, whether the games are good or not. Like, out of how many years have the Lions actually been good on Thanksgiving Day? There's been a bunch of years where the Cowboys weren't great. But it's just, you got all-day football, you sit back, and whether you're American or not, I'm just like, I'm treating this as a mini holiday. And, you know, I can use the excuse as like, I gotta watch it for work, honey. Sorry. You know.
Oh, I pull that every Sunday. You can imagine how well that goes over in my household.
We're professionals, but, Matt. We're professionals.
Exactly.
Damn it.
That's what I say. Like, I used to say it like half jokingly that I have to do it for work, but now that I'm writing for Sportsnet.ca, I legitimately have to watch as much football as humanly possible. Like, there is no question about it. Like, I have to be glued to the TV. And honestly, being glued to the TV today is, it's never a problem, but man, the first game was a glorious tire fire for the first half, and then Houston just pulled away and made it almost completely uninteresting. And then this game just lacks two powerful offenses. The first half was pretty good. This third quarter has been an absolute drag, and I'm not gonna lie, I'm kind of pissed off because my you know, over 10.5 is not happening. So I'm a little bit perturbed by that.
Yeah, well, especially Alex Smith, just a few minutes before we came on the air, I don't know if he forgot what team he was on or the color of his jersey, but that right into the breadbasket of the Dallas Cowboys defender interception was disgusting. And so now they're up 20-16. And yeah, like going back to the first game too, going in, I was like, okay, how is this going to play out? Because I found the matchup sort of interesting on the running side because both teams were near or literally at the bottom when it came to rushing average per game. But on the other side, both teams were one of the worst at defending the run. So I just kind of wondered, like, by accident, is somebody going to go off? The answer was no. You had two touchdowns from Adrian Peterson, who for at one point had like 8 carries for 6 yards and 2 touchdowns. And Duke Johnson ran for his usual next to nothing.
Yeah, it wasn't pretty. And I think the one thing that you can take from it is that you see how anemic the Lions offense is without Kenny Golladay and now without DeAndre Swift, who, as someone who has him rostered in a couple of leagues that is trying to vie for first place overall in both of those leagues, not really great to not have DeAndre Swift in the lineup. But it does show you everything that is about that offense. Those are the two most dynamic playmakers. And TJ Hawkinson's a close third. Actually, I do want to get to Hawkinson in a second
because I
saw something that was, yeah, he's great. You know what? The heck with it. I'm going to get to it now. This is going to be a little bit of a rant here, so just kind of bear with me.
Okay.
But I was
on
the phone. He was involved in this play, and you'll kind of get where I'm going with this. So it was third and 11. I believe it was third and 11, or it was fourth and one, something. I can't remember what the play was, but Detroit needs to get a first down because they're down by 17 in the fourth quarter and they need to make some sort of a move offensively. Hawkinson gets called on a really cheap offensive pass interference. Like it was complete trash. And then you're now third and 11. And Matt Patricia or Daryl Bevel, whoever it was, but at the end of the day, it's going to fall on the head coach, and TJ Hawkinson is not on the field.
Wow.
Marvin Jones is now your best player on offense because TJ Hawkinson is not on the field. He's your most dynamic player when you do not have Swift or Golladay in the lineup. So what happens? Where do they throw the ball? They throw the ball to Jesse James, who doesn't convert on the first down. They then hand the ball off to a fullback who nobody's ever heard of, and you wouldn't know him if you hit him with your car, and he doesn't convert on the first down. Houston gets the ball. They score a touchdown on the weirdest play that I think I've ever seen in football, and the game is over. This falls on the head coach. I am sorry. Why are you taking him out for a play like that? Third and 11, you take your best pass catcher off the field. Matt Patricia should absolutely 100% be axed. And Andy, if you noticed at the end of the game, they were in no hurry on offense to snap the ball. They're down by, I think it was 16 points, so 2-score game, and it took them over 15 seconds between plays to snap the ball. That is a team that is disinterested. That is a team that does not want to win to keep their coach's job. He will be gone before Adam Gase, which is absolutely frightening, but here we are.
Matt,
end of rant.
Of all, first of all, how dare you belittle the contribution of Jason Kabinda, the fullback from Penn State.
Exactly.
Of the Detroit, like, one carry. Come on. Like, are we not all on the Kabinda bandwagon? No, I'm totally with you. Matt Patricia, from the start, has carried himself. Brian Flores is the exception to the rule of that Belichick tree, right? And you know what? Give Bill O'Brien credit. He lasted a while in Houston. He ended up destroying the franchise with giving away their draft picks. But for Matt Patricia encompasses everything of your typical Belichick disciple. Comes in way too cocky, way too full of themselves. I came from here. You didn't do squat, bro. That was Bill. That was Uncle Bill. You were there. Cool. And you want to carry yourself like you're Bill Belichick, and you're not. Remember he commented to, like, a reporter, like, sit up, you shouldn't slouch. Really? Well, now that guy and that media is going to punk you, and you deserve it. Because like you said, the lackadaisical effort on offense, and everything falls back to him even if he's not calling the play. He hired the OC. So you have weird gimmick plays like that. It's trying to be too smart, Matt. And that's what I find that a lot of the Belichick guys do. They try to be too smart. They think they're too clever. Sometimes the easy thing, put your best damn playmaker, your big tight end that can move the chains and be a threat in the red zone, on the field. Like, there's not too much to compute there. And you're right, he's going to be there. I think it should be absolutely in this order. Adam Gase, 1,000% fired versus the worst head coach in pro football. And Matt Patricia is second right behind him.
Oh, yeah, and that is no question. The one thing that I do love about that Matt Patricia telling the reporter to sit up, like, not for anything. I'm a guy that likes to grow a good beard, but has Matt Patricia looked in the mirror at any point?
Oh, I know.
Like, he doesn't strike me as... Yeah, he doesn't strike me as Mr. Professionalism, but I don't know, maybe...
As a three-piece suit guy?
Yeah, no. He's a sweatpants and hoodie kind of guy. Like, he's
nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, and that's fine, but don't comment on somebody else the way they're sitting. Like, you demand this respect because
exactly.
Yeah, it's a joke. But
it's so
here,
stupid.
Here we are. Matt Patricia's gonna, like, the other thing too is these coaches are, you know, like you mentioned, they're almost a victim of their own stubbornness, I guess, or arrogance, one of the two.
Yep.
But,
both sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes both. But how does it take you 10 weeks or 11 weeks to figure out that DeAndre Swift is your most dynamic playmaker? In Baltimore, how does it take you 11 weeks to figure out that J.K. Dobbins is your most dynamic running back and maybe your most talented player on the field? Why in Washington did it take them so long to figure out that Antonio Gibson is behind Terry McLaurin, their second best offensive player? Like, that kind of stuff just absolutely befuddles me. You spend the draft capital on these guys. Why don't you play them?
Yes.
That, I never, I know there's a learning curve, but the learning curve in the NFL for these young players is so much less. We see rookies come in and make an impact right away. We, you know, Clyde Edwards-Helaire in his first game. Yes, I understand that Kansas City offense lends itself to, you know, putting up good numbers. But he still came in and made an impact in his first game. We've seen CeeDee Lamb before the Dak Prescott injury was great. Chase Claypool has been great. Justin Jefferson's been great. Jerry Jeudy, I think, is Michael Pittman Jr. has been great. I think Jerry Jeudy is hampered by terrible quarterback play in Denver. So this notion of, you know, these guys need to bide their time. No, it's all a bunch of BS. First of all, when you spend the draft capital, you better figure out what these guys are. Because
that's
if you don't,
understand.
Then you're screwed.
Yeah, I don't understand when you draft somebody and like Jonathan Taylor even in Indianapolis as well. You got Nyheim Hines, that's fine. You spent a high pick on Jonathan Taylor. And what always confuses me, Matt, is you hear about these coaches. Oh, they spend 23 hours a day in their office. They have cots in there. They don't go home for weeks and all that. And then come game day, and you're like, what did you do all week, man? Like, what? Like, maybe you just worked too hard and drove yourself squirrely or something, but... For some of these guys, and it's just so confusing. And I believe it's a rare coach, and there are some, but it's rare when you get a guy, especially first-time head coaches, who want, they finally got their shot, right? They finally, okay, this is mine. No, I can't show weakness. I can't go away from what I've done because that would show I don't know what I'm doing. Instead of being egoless and trying to improve and grow, and those are the guys who you see are 1 or 2 years, and then they're back being a coordinator somewhere.
Yeah, and so I for my 10 fantasy thoughts that came out yesterday, I did a kind of a breakdown on the two running backs that we had mentioned. One was Dobbins, and then you had mentioned Jonathan Taylor. So a lot of these guys, when they are in college or they get to the NFL, they need workload. They need to handle touches to get into the game. So if you look at the difference in care, so J.K. Dobbins, when he in two games when he's been given 15 carries, he has averaged 6.1 yards per carry. Jonathan Taylor, when he has seen 12 or more carries, has an average of 4.25 yards per carry. Do you have a guess of what his yards per carry is when he has 11 carries or less?
Oh, I bet you it's 3 or less.
It's 2.5.
Wow.
That's a significant difference when you're talking about, you know, usage for these guys. It totally blows my mind because they clearly have something, but there's also the notion that they do need a heavier workload in order to perform at these levels that they were performing at in college. J.K. Dobbins had the same thing when he was at – you're an Ohio State fan. You know, yeah. The more J.K. Dobbins got the rock, the better he played.
All game. And he was a guy, Matt, where for J.K. Dobbins – and for Jonathan Taylor, too. Look, in Wisconsin, the guy had 2,000 yards in consecutive season, 300-plus touches. Just from a common-sense standpoint, that shows you these guys are workhorses. These guys need the ball. And for J.K. Dobbins, watching those games last year for the Buckeyes, he quite often, if you look at the overall numbers, like, wow. But a lot of those came in the second half. It's when he wore that. He's a wear-you-down type of back. He's dynamic, but he's a wear-you-down guy. He's going to make his money midway through late in the third quarter. That's when he goes through. And when you take that away from guys like that, not every running back's like that. Some guys can be zippy and touch and go. But those two specifically need that workload. And that's shocking to me that the coaches, the GMs, whatever, who bring these guys in, don't utilize them that way and aren't patient enough.
Well, I want the audience to understand, we're not saying that we're smarter than NFL coaches, because we're not. There's a reason why we're talking about them and they're not listening to us. But having said that, when you look at sheer numbers, they do tell a story most of the time. And that's the thing that I don't understand is not only do they tell a story, but when you watch the game, Andy, I think it's safe to say that Jonathan Taylor, when you watch him, is a better back than Nyheim Hines and Jordan Wilkins. J.K. Dobbins is better than Mark Ingram and Gus Edwards. DeAndre Swift is better than Adrian Peterson and Kerryon Johnson. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I just don't understand why these guys don't do it. As I'm watching now, Antonio Gibson just breaks off a huge run for a touchdown. So
what a stud.
Yeah, and this is what I'm saying. You have, in the NFL, it is a passing league, but you do not, generally speaking, have success offensively unless you can run the ball. There's not many teams that are outliers for that. The Steelers this year, I think, have been kind of outliers for that. They're running a lot of three wide receiver sets and empty backfields, and the Bills would be the other exception to that rule.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what has
balance.
To happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, everybody's got to have a balance. And the thing with the Steelers is, with James Conner, teams know if they need to run it, they can. Right? They're not, but they can. And for the Bills, I think that might be a case too, just based on the talent of Singletary and Moss. You'd like to think they could. It's just, Matt, right now, you know what? It's clicking with Josh Allen and company. Why mess with it? My fear is when the weather really starts to turn, even with Allen's big arm that can put it through weather, I wouldn't mind, if I'm a Buffalo Bills fan, seeing the run game maybe get a little bit more usage just to make sure things are up and clicking when you need to go to it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the idea of being able to close out games. That's the big thing when you're talking about, you know, really good teams and finishing it off. A guy like J.K. Dobbins, who is a closer, or was in college anyway, we haven't seen it at the NFL level yet, or a guy like Nick Chubb of your Browns, who is a closer. That guy can get the job done and finish games off. So it's frustrating, but I don't know. What are you going to do, right? We can kind of talk about this until we're blue in the face, but we won't. But we do want to get to this, our question for the evening, and that is in honor of American Thanksgiving. We asked the question, because Andy and I are both fantasy guys, which player on your fantasy team are you most thankful for? You could tweet us at MattSN590, at AndyMC81, or at Fan590, or you can text us at 590-590. Give us your name and location, and we'll read through some of those later on tonight. But coming up after the break, Matt Patricia still has a job for now.
For now.
Deshaun Watson puts on a show in his first ever Thanksgiving Day start, and the Cowboys are kind of just barely hanging around against the Washington football team. We're going to talk to Brendan Deeg next, National Football Post and co-host of the Double Doink podcast. You're listening to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, alongside me, Andy McNamara. And joining us on the line to chat a little Thanksgiving Day football is Brendan Deeg, National Football Post and co-host of the Double Doink podcast. Brendan, how are you tonight?
I'm doing good. I'm actually a little jealous of our neighbors in the south today because I could use some stuffing and turkey, that's for sure.
Well, Andy and I were talking about that. Like, they really do things right in the U.S. I mean, they get the Thursday off. It's football all day. You get to stuff your face, like you said, with stuffing and turkey and all the fixings and everything like that. And then you get Friday off, and exactly. Then you have the weekend. We really, really missed the boat on this one, I'm pretty sure.
Canada needs to step up its Thanksgiving game.
Yeah, exactly. Earlier today, the Lions lose to the Texans. They generally stink on Thanksgiving. Over the past few years, they just generally stink. Matt Patricia gets brought in. They fired Jim Caldwell, which in hindsight really looks like a mistake, considering that Caldwell at least had a little bit of success. But I was saying to Andy earlier on, what I saw at the end of the game today was a team that was down 16 points with, you know, 4 or 5 minutes left, and they had no urgency to get to the line. It was taking like 15, 16 seconds between, you know, after the end of the play to snapping the ball, and it just looked like a team that didn't want to play for their coach. Is this just a matter of time before Matt Patricia's gone?
Yeah, I actually wrote about this on the National Football Post this week. I predicted that this will probably be Matt Patricia's last game. I think it's time. You got to let him go after this. This was a pitiful effort. Like you said, you can almost tell like these players don't even want to play for him anymore. This is now 29 losses in 2.5 years. That's pretty crazy considering Jim Caldwell only lost 28 games in 4 years, and they let him go with a 9-7 record. So when you kind of bring in a guy like Matt Patricia after that, it just gone completely downhill after the fact that you had a competent coach before. I just think it's time to go and kind of hit the reset button on this. I'd actually like to see Matthew Stafford in this offense kind of with another offensive coach, but I don't know if they're going to hang on to Stafford. His time might be done in Detroit as well. So, but yeah, I'm with you on this one. I think it's time Matt Patricia gets the kick out of Detroit.
Well, and Brendan, for sure. And the thing is, if you look at the team, specifically on offense, you have pieces. Like, you have some good building blocks. Now, Kenny Golladay, the injury bug has bitten him this year. Nothing you can do about that. But you have Golladay. You have Marvin Jones as a two. I love him. Mohamed Sanu started to pop a little bit today. DeAndre Swift in the backfield is sensational if he's given a chance. And that's it's all part of all the final decisions, of course, fall on the head coach. The committee aspect, we're seeing it in Baltimore, too. Matt and I were talking about it. Some of these guys need to get into a rhythm, right? They need, like, if you have 3-4 guys touching the ball, nobody gets into a rhythm, then the whole thing doesn't work. You become one-dimensional, and everything falls apart. So I'm with you. I would like to see an offensive coach, because I still think Matthew Stafford, when healthy, he can still distribute the ball. You just need somebody, some way, to help put them over at the head coaching spot.
Yeah, and this you said it perfectly. And this team's actually they're in some trouble this year when it comes to free agents leaving. They only have one wide receiver on the roster that's signed into 2021, and that's the rookie Cyphus they took in the fifth round. Marvin Jones, Amendola, and Kenny Golladay are all free agents at the end of this year. So if I'm Matthew Stafford, I don't even know if I want to stay, considering the fact that they already have some cap issues, and they're gonna have to sign all these guys back. And Stafford's actually just a straight up different quarterback without Kenny Golladay. And you notice it today. He struggles without him, and historically, when he's been in the past 2 years, when Golladay's been in the lineup, they've been a better team. So that was a huge loss today. And in general, yeah, this Lions team has a lot more questions than answers, that's for sure.
Brendan Deeg is our guest here, writer for National Football Post and co-host of the Double Doink podcast. And I actually kind of wanted to look at the Matt Stafford thing from a different light. I see the way he plays. He's been in the league a long time. I just view him right now as a middle-of-the-road NFL starter. He's, you know, you can certainly name 14 or 15 guys that are at better and or, you know, maybe close to better than Matthew Stafford at this point. I just, he's not the guy that I think we thought he was going to be. And granted, yes, he's been on some bad teams, but I just don't know. We've certainly seen the ceiling for him, and I don't think he's getting back there anytime soon.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting this year in general in the NFL. You've got, like, the top quarterbacks in Mahomes, Wilson, Murray, and you have, like, four or five. And then you kind of have, like, this, like, group of 15 quarterbacks in the middle that are all kind of around the same. You got, like, the Matt Ryans, the Matthew Staffords of the world. So I think he can still play at a somewhat high level. I know he hasn't looked like it in the past couple of years. It's just because of the incompetence in Detroit in general. So if I'm him, I want out of there. And I think Detroit's probably going to end up wanting to get rid of him as well. I think they're going to want to hit the reset button. You're going to probably see a coach like maybe Joe Brady, who's the offensive coordinator of the Carolina Panthers, or some sort of offensive mind come in and want to kind of build with a new starting quarterback, a guy like Zach Wilson from BYU. A quarterback like that, you're not going to get Trevor Lawrence, but there's actually two or three other quarterbacks, Justin Fields, Zach Wilson, a guy like that can step in and play right away and kind of build a new era of football in Detroit.
And if we switch it up to the game that's on now and that NFC East story, right? Like really, no matter how bad these teams look, any one of them could still win, right? They're all under 500. It's a complete train wreck. Someone's got to win, or maybe not lose it. Maybe that's the better way. No one's winning it, so not losing enough. What frustrates me, and maybe it's the fantasy football guy in me, but like the numbers Terry McLaurin puts up with average at best quarterback play in his short career, I think have been astounding. And we all love Alex Smith, the story coming back with the leg. Love it, love it. But that's not your future franchise quarterback. If you get Terry McLaurin, like the guy's 92 yards today, the guy just puts up all these great numbers with just average to below average QBs chucking it to him. Like, I would just love to see McLaurin with a great quarterback. Like, this guy could legitimately, Brendan, be like one or number two, the best wide receiver in football.
He's actually like my favorite player inside the NFC East. I'm an Eagles fan, so outside of the Philadelphia Eagles, he's my favorite player in the NFC East. There was a video of him actually like blocking like downfield a defensive lineman last week. Like he does it all. He blocks fast. He's got great hands. He's like the perfect receiver. And Washington got really lucky to get him at pick 99 coming out of Ohio State. He's fast. He's big. He does it all. I'm with you. He's probably my favorite player in the NFC East outside the Eagles. And he hasn't even hit a ceiling yet. He's only 25 years old. He's gonna get even better, which is scary. And yeah, Washington is definitely gonna be in the market for a quarterback. Alex Smith, if you were watching, just had a big pick six to Jalen Smith. So you know what? He might be good enough to get them to an NFC East championship this year, which is pretty crazy. But they're definitely gonna have to move on, and they're gonna be a team like Detroit in that kind of like draft pick area. If they don't win the NFC East, they'll be in a draft pick area of around like 5 to 10, and you should be able to find a quarterback there to take. So I think they're in good shape on offense with Antonio Gibson and Terry McLaurin. They just need that quarterback to take them to the next level.
Brendan, you mentioned Antonio Gibson, and he's finally starting to get that workload. He's had it in a couple of games, but I think going forward, it's going to be a little bit more consistent for him. And today he has 19 rushes for 78 yards, two touchdowns. He's also got two catches for 21 yards. Five catches for 21 yards on seven targets. They're finally starting to incorporate him into the offense, and the offense has looked better because of it. Granted, they are playing the Dallas Cowboys defense, who has been better of late. Certainly not world beaters, but they've been better. Is he the guy? Because McLaurin, until they get a quarterback, is going to be kind of limited, but is he the guy that this offense should revolve around going forward? Like, do you think he is that good?
I do. And you can just tell that he's getting more touches. these past few weeks, and you can tell their offense is starting to take off. I actually tweeted, I said he's already has 14 touches in the game, or 15 touches in the game, and there were still 8 minutes left in the second quarter. Like, they were feeding him early in this game, like almost every other play. He is a touch monster. So yeah, I think he's a guy that, like, him and McLaurin, that's as good as like a 1-2 punch you can get from your running back and wide receiver. I think he's legit. He was kind of a fantasy dark horse this year, and then he didn't really pan out at the beginning. I know a lot of people were kind of saying to take him later in the draft, so he'll help you out later down the road, and he has. I think they got something going with him and McLaurin, definitely. He's fun to watch.
Brendan Deeg is our guest here on Sportsnet tonight, Matt Marchese and Adney McNamara.
And Brendan, when we look at, just to stick with Antonio Gibson for a moment, the physical specimen that he is, 6'2", 220, and what caught my eye in the preseason was that Ron Rivera said he is a Christian McCaffrey type of weapon. I was like, okay, that's not necessarily something that Ron, just coming from Carolina, is going to be throwing around. And the thing is, he was so raw and such a question. You looked at the tools, you looked at what he could be. It was still an unknown because he barely played in college. Like, barely. Like I think it was less than 100 snaps in his college career, something ridiculous. And it was all projection. And to see him start to do what he's doing as a rookie this year, like, we're part way through. Like, this guy's ceiling could be incredible. Again, looking at that NFC East, you just got to sort of figure out that quarterback situation. Maybe keep Smith as a backup. What do you think happens to Dwayne Haskins? Talk about Ohio State. I think he got hosed a little bit just with development, but he's clearly not in their plans going forward.
No, he wasn't. I don't think him and Rivera kind of got along from the start. You can tell the day he got benched, he was actually benched the third string behind Alex Smith and Kyle Allen earlier. And there was a picture of him on the sidelines, like doing like scout team for punts and punt return at practice. So he pretty much got demoted as far as he can as a quarterback in Washington. Yeah, he definitely has other plans. He'll definitely be traded this offseason. It's a guy that I would take a flyer on. He's a young dude. He's big. The one thing against him is he's not very mobile. He's pretty slow in the pocket, and he's got that Nick Foles kind of statue look to him when he's in the pocket, which is a problem. But he's got the talent. He threw 50 touchdowns at Ohio State before he was drafted, so you know there's some talent there. And it's definitely a guy that a team kind of like a contending team, kind of like, I don't know about Green Bay because they drafted Jordan Love, but a team kind of like that you can trade like a low round pick for. Like a fifth, sixth, seventh round pick, and then you can develop him for 2 years and see what you got. Because like quarterbacks like that don't come easy, right? He was just taken the first round, so definitely a guy that you could take a flyer on if you're a competitive team to be a backup or a third string. But yeah, he's definitely not in Washington's plans, that's for sure. Ron Rivera and him did not get along from the start.
And of course, as we talk about Antonio Gibson, he scores for the third time tonight, and I wanted to look at the Dallas side of things because They're going to have to do some maneuvering, and one of their biggest problems is the contract that they gave to Ezekiel Elliott. I, as someone who kind of despises the Cowboys, as I'm sure you do as an Eagles fan, I kind of want to see them have to make a decision between a top-flight quarterback in the draft and Dak Prescott to see how crazy Jerry Jones is, because I still think the answer is Dak Prescott. But you know, the Ezekiel Elliott contract right now, and I don't know how much of his play is because of, you know, the lack of talent at quarterback, the offensive line's been really banged up. But when you look historically, those big running back contracts, how many of them have we seen that actually pan out? We saw Le'Veon Bell in New York didn't pan out. We saw the Todd Gurley contract with the Rams not pan out. Are we looking at this Ezekiel Elliott contract in the same light right now?
Definitely. They paid, it was like a 6-year, $90 million contract. I think like $50 million over guaranteed. Like, they gave him a boatload of money. And earlier on in the game today, it was 4th and inches, and they were running a 10-yard hitch route to CeeDee Lamb. They're not giving the ball to the running back they gave $90 million to on 4th and inches. So you can kind of see the trust factor almost slipping away with the Cowboys and Elliott as well. He's had a rough year. He has 5 fumbles now, and I think there's one guy with 4 fumbles, and then there's no one else with at least 3. Their next guy's a 2. So he's a far and beyond above all the rest of the running backs in the NFL of holding on to the ball. He cannot do it right now. He's having fumbling issues. He only has, I think, 2 yards of over, or 2 runs of over 20 yards. this year as well. So like those big kind of big hitter games that he was getting as a rookie in the second year are just not there right now. So yeah, they're definitely regretting signing him to that contract. And when you brought up the Dak Prescott situation earlier, I have a hard time believing they'll draft a quarterback. Just the fact that there are so many holes on this roster. You can just tell the defense is depleted. Their offensive line is starting to go down now. Tyron Smith is getting old at left tackle. There's a tackle out of Oregon that's going to go in the top like five picks. So if they can get in that top five pick, you'll probably see them take an offensive lineman or a game-changing defensive player over drafting a quarterback. Because look, Dak Prescott was like the only good thing the team had for them this year. I know he went down injured. I know he went down with an injury and he's done for the year. But before that, he was playing at a high level. If I'm Jerry Jones, I take an offensive lineman or a defensive player that can help me out down the road.
And Washington just got a pick six off of a bad Andy Dalton turnover. And woo! Washington putting the boots. Wow. So yeah, let's look at this NFC.
They're clearly the best coach team in the NFC East, at least.
No doubt.
You can say that. Like, Ron Rivera's got the team playing hard. You can see on defense as well. They're feisty. And the Washington defense is probably the best unit in the NFC East, like, defense or offensive side of the ball. Like, they have a top five defense right now going, and not even just, like, stats, just the eye test. They pass the eye test as well. They have a ferocious D-line. So, honestly, Washington's probably the favorite to win this division, which is crazy.
Well, yeah. If they win it, they're 4-7, and that puts them in the driver's seat. And you look at that Washington defensive line. All four starters on the D-line, first-round picks. The first guy off the bench was a former first-round pick, so they got that. But when we look at this NFC East overall, okay, Eagles in front right now, and when you look at how this could play out, where do the New York Giants fit in? Because it looks like the Eagles with Carson Wentz, he just needs to find himself. Looks like he's just in his own head or whatever. But the Giants are very gradually, and it hasn't shown up in the standings, but I feel, Brandon, like the Giants are gradually figuring it out under the new head coach. They're gradually improving. We start to see steps. And it's almost like if you don't pay attention, you're not going to see it. But they're becoming a tougher and tougher out. Where do you feel the Giants work into this NFC East mix for this season?
Yeah, they're playing really good football right now. They should have won that Thursday night game against the Eagles. The Eagles came back in a game-winning drive, and the Giants outplayed the Eagles that entire game. And then on Monday night, they almost beat the Buccaneers a couple weeks ago. And then they come back the week after that and beat down the Eagles. It wasn't a beat down scoreboard-wise, but if you watch the game like I did, the Giants completely outplayed them. So, yeah, I think the Giants are right there. They're playing good football right now. They're kind of rallying around Joe Judge, their head coach they brought in from – he was a special teams coordinator for the Patriots for a bunch of years. He's kind of got more of like an old-school football kind of attitude that a lot of players weren't buying into. And then there was a rumor that he was getting in a fight with his offensive line coach just like last week. So there's definitely some issues there, but they've got some good talent. They're on defense, James Bradbury's playing at a very high level. That's one of the better free agent additions. Their defensive line is able to get pressure too. And look, Daniel Jones isn't turning the football over right now. When you don't turn over the football, they seem to win games. I think he went like three straight games or two straight games without a turnover, and they went 2-0. So it just goes to show if Jones can just hold on to the ball and not fumble it, and he's led the league in fumbles since he's been in the league last year. So he's got some turnover issues, but if he can just kind of hold that down and keep it to a minimum, I think they're right there. I think it's probably going to come down to Washington and New York. New York, I think, is the easiest schedule down the stretch as well for the out of all the NFC East teams. So, look, they could be in the playoffs. It's not crazy to think about that.
A little bit of breaking news. One more before we let you go, but a little bit of breaking news. This is from Ian Rappaport. Ravens star quarterback Lamar Jackson, I don't know about the star part right now, but anyway, has tested positive for COVID-19. So that would certainly rule him out for any game on Sunday if that game still goes as planned. That's messy. Now, sticking with the NFC East, because it is easily the most interesting division in football, more with your favorite team, why is Doug Peterson so surprised that people think that Carson Wentz should be benched? I don't know if he's watching the same games as we are, but there's something off there, and it might be a good idea at this point just to have him sit down and just kind of rethink things at this point.
No, I agree with you. I've been kind of screaming to get Carson Wentz on the bench ever since that Dallas Cowboys Sunday night game where he had like four turnovers. He was bad in that game. He should have been benched there. Look, the weirdest part about this whole thing is the Eagles brought this on themselves. They spent a second round pick drafting Jalen Hurts. So if you're going to do that, you have to expect, if your starting quarterback doesn't play well, that the media is going to be asking, why not use the second-round pick you invested, right? So this is kind of like they brought this onto themselves, which is crazy, the fact that they don't see that. They're thinking this is a made-up narrative, and it's not. Carson Wentz is not playing good football right now. He's struggling. You can clearly see there's disconnect with him and Doug Peterson. The play calling, too, has been atrocious. This offense in general, guys, is bad. They're ranked 30th in offensive DVOA, which is an analytics stat. So they're at the bottom of Jacksonville and the Jets when it comes to offense. They are just straight up boring to watch as well on offense. Carson Wentz and his receivers don't have any connect. Travis Fulgham has completely disappeared. They have no idea what to do with Jalen Reagor, the guy they took in the first round. They can't seem to get him the ball in space. It's just an overall mess. And I think the only way to kind of maybe give Carson Wentz a shakeup is by benching him. And look, you can go back to your quarterback. It happens all the time. Look what the Dolphins just did. They just benched Tua because he wasn't playing well, and they put in a guy who they thought had the best chance to win. That's not bad for your team. I don't get why Doug Peterson thinks it is. Play the guy who you think has the best chance to win this to win the game. And right now, it's probably Jalen Hurts, which is crazy, the fact that Carson Wentz has fallen this much in the past 3 years. But it's just not there mentally. You can almost like see the gears turning in his head when you watch him play. He just doesn't look like he knows what's going on. He can't find his first read. He can't find the open player. And that was one of his better traits in 2017. So it's not working right now, and I think it could get really ugly on Monday night against the Seahawks.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it might get real ugly because that defense is playing a lot better. Brendan, thank you so much for taking some time for us today. I know we didn't take you away from too much from this game because, well, it's over now. But thank you very much for your time, and hopefully we'll chat again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. Have a good night.
Brendan Deeg, writer for the National Football Post and co-host of the Double Doink podcast, our guest here on Sportsnet tonight. Andy, I mean, the Carson Wentz thing is completely mind-blowing. We talked about stubbornness with coaches, how it can be their downfall and the arrogance. Oblivion might be another thing that causes coaches to end up losing their jobs, because to say that Carson Wentz hasn't been the problem, I get that they are very banged up on that offensive line, but this is a guy who was putting up MVP-type numbers one year before he got hurt. So it's not, there's something either between the ears, or maybe he's just lost it. But to question why people think he should be benched, I think is... arrogant isn't even the word. I think it's... he's almost... like, he makes people like he thinks other people are stupid, I guess. I don't know, because we're certainly not seeing the same thing.
Well, yeah, and I don't know what's scarier, arrogance or being oblivious, like honestly not seeing it. Like, if you're an Eagles fan, like, what's more concerning? Because I certainly, look, I don't blame Carson Wentz fully. No, look at I blame the front office. Look at the crap they gave him at wide receiver. And 2 years in a row, to think that DeSean Jackson and Alshon Jeffrey, even when you brought them in, were going to be healthy, was ludicrous. And they haven't been, because they haven't for like 5 years. To think that, and you have that, then the defense gets banged up, then the offensive line. But what's concerning with Carson Wentz is, and especially watching the Browns beat them last week, watching him, I'm like, what am I seeing here in this guy? Like, he was tremendous as a rookie. We're seeing him hold on to the ball. He can't make decisions. He's taking sacks. He's making bad throws for pick sixes. Like, it's something's loose. And I think, to Brendan's point, having that seat maybe clears it up a little bit, right? And I like Jalen Hurts. Like, now I like Jalen Hurts coming out of the draft. I think if Philly is smart, they don't just try to use him as a gimmick quarterback, because the way that guy developed the last year of college, he can make pro throws, and he was on that route. So I hope he's getting developed, because it would be a shame to waste that talent as a quarterback, not a runner, a quarterback in Jalen Hurts. I think he could come in and maybe replace Carson Wentz.
Well, there is a reason why they took him where they did in the draft. There's no question about that. Yeah, it's, hey, I believe that anything can happen in 2020, and I said before the season, Jalen Hurts will make starts for this Eagles team. I thought it was because Carson Wentz was going to get banged up, but now it's going to be because of futility, because that's the way that this is going right now. We got to hit the break here, but coming up after, we're going to chat a big news for the Canadian sports gambling scene. The Canadian government is pushing towards something that could be a huge revenue generator. We're going to talk about that coming up. This is Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Andy McNamara. And Andy, before the break, we had the breaking news from Ian Rappaport that Lamar Jackson has tested positive for COVID-19, and that puts he will not play on Sunday. But Andy, do you think this game is going to happen with all these tests?
I think this is going to be fascinating to see how the league handles this, because Matt, this is the first star quarterback that has got COVID and will miss time, right? Not preseason. Matt Stafford had it during the preseason and all that, but this is your reigning MVP in year who is supposed to be, you know, everything to everybody, and he's going to miss the game. They already moved it from tonight to Sunday. I think if you move this game, that will create chaos around the league, because then every other team can make the case, well, our offensive lineman's very important to us. How come you've had the Raiders miss offensive line, almost all defensive line? The Jaguars are missing their whole defensive coaching staff. Like, where does it stop? You have the NFL provided expanded practice squads, and you got a backup. If it's me, too bad. RG3 time. See what you can do against Pittsburgh. And by the way, that line's 4.5 right now. If it's me, I'm emptying my pockets. All my money on the Steelers, please.
Yeah, and I guess we can say that Cam Newton missed some time with COVID, but he's certainly not of the level right now of Lamar Jackson. So I totally get what you're saying. Yeah, I totally agree with that. So with that being said, it is really interesting, because if there's one team that's going to be really, really pissed off about this, it's going to be the Pittsburgh Steelers. They already had their bye week changed. Mm-hmm. They couldn't play tonight because of, I guess, quote-unquote special circumstances, and they pushed the game to Sunday. If I'm the Steelers, and they've already voiced their opinions, if this game doesn't go off on Sunday, especially because it's a divisional game, there's going to be hell to pay.
Well, yeah. And for the Steelers, like, I this might be the one time I defend them, Matt, but, like, I'm on their side. Okay, we've done nothing wrong. We're following protocol. You punished us once for a team that was careless. You're punishing us twice for a team that was even more careless, letting a strength and conditioning guy walk around without a mat. Then you fake discipline him? If it's me too, hey, John McClain told us on the air last night. He said if it was him, out of the Houston Chronicle, legendary NFL writer, he said if it was up to him, Ravens would lose a first-round pick. I don't think the league will go that strong, but if it's me, Matt, like, you got to send a message here. That's ridiculous. Not only the from the play standpoint, like, you could kill somebody. Like, we don't know how this affects individual people. You're that careless? You got to send a message. I think you get all the fines you can, and right away for the Ravens, you're like, third-round pick, gone. Try us. See what happens next.
Yeah, I agree. There is something that we wanted to get to quickly before the break, and we're going to hear an interview from Writer's Block earlier today, and you know, this is a big deal for sports gamblers, for the Canadian government, for Canadians in general as an added revenue stream, especially in the economic circumstances that we are in right now. But the federal government introduced a bill today proposing to decriminalize single event sports betting in Canada. And for those that are familiar with sports betting in Canada, you know, you have to bet on a minimum of 3 events on a pro line ticket. Now, there's already a lot of betting going on. Per CBC News, sports bettors across the country lay roughly $500 million a year on parlay bets through places like ProLine. So imagine what that number would be if people just could bet on one game. That is an absolutely huge, huge amount of money. And when you talk about, you know, the gambling market, there's an estimated $14 billion that is thrown out on the block. Outlets, or, and that's all according to the Canadian Gaming Association. That's where they can gamble on just a single game. Andy, that's a huge revenue stream for the Canadian government.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it, right? Like, and really, how much more fun do you hear from people in, you know, in the States, or if you're in Vegas, you know, what if I don't want to bet on 3 games, right? What if I don't want to do that? What if I just want to bet on this one particular thing and not have it, you know, on some site that might be trustworthy, might not be in Canada, right? That's the thing that's so that's so up in the air. But yeah, if you're the government, you don't want to let that cash cow go. I get it, but you know.
Yeah, you definitely need that added revenue stream. Like I said, the government and the economy has already taken a hit during the pandemic. So I think the added revenue stream would be a very, very welcome sight. What was a welcome sight earlier this week was the Raptors locking up Fred VanVleet to a 4-year contract. They did lose some pieces in the process, and they made a move today. We're going to talk to Sean Woodley from the Locked On Raptors podcast when we come back. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Don't get left in the dark. Let us shine a light on everything you need to know. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Welcome back to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Andy McNamara. You can follow us on Twitter at MattSN590 and at AndyMC81. Coming up in the next block, we got to get this out there. If you want to win Andy's Pizza, be the first and second person to text in with your name and location, and you can win a chance, or you can have a chance to win Andy's Pizza. Our producer, Sho Ali, and myself will be playing for you, and you better hope that you don't get me because I lost earlier this week. But first, joining us on the line is Sean Woodley from the Locked On Raptors podcast. Sean, how are you tonight?
Guys, I'm good. How's it going?
We're excellent. The NFL slate is over for the day, so we can now focus on no sports tonight. It's awesome. The big news of the week for the Raptors was, of course, locking up Fred VanVleet to a 4-year deal. I think people have lost sight of the fact that he may have been the best free agent available, because I think we can all say that Anthony Davis isn't really available. But is there something to be said for this organization to have a player of that stature, regardless of who else is available? Because Fred VanVleet could have gone anywhere. To have him come back to this organization and commit to a 4-year deal?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen kind of over the last decade the long-term sort of, trauma of Raptors fans and knowing that, you know, you kind of get 7 years with a guy at the most and he's probably going to dip after his second contract. You know, I think that's gone away. You know, Kyle Lowry signed, I think it's now 3 different contracts with the Raptors. It might be 4 at this point with the extension. It's crazy the number of times he's re-upped. DeMar DeRozan re-upped. Obviously, Serge Ibaka did the first time he was with the Raptors after just half a season and stuck around. And now Fred VanVleet's just the latest in the line. And I think, look, it's always going to be difficult, I think, to kind of get people to come for the first time. You know, it's still a different country. It's still, you know, there's still, I think, a bit of a stigma attached to going to play in Canada or whatever. But I do think that's going away. And I think the fact that the Raptors are one of the sort of marquee franchises now in terms of, you know, not only the size of their market, which I think people are realizing, like, oh, yeah, this is an insane basketball city with, you know, it's as big and robust as any city there is in the States, but also it's a franchise that knows what it's doing and can actually help you milk as much as you can out of your prime as an NBA player, whether you're, you know, a guy who's sort of a G League, a fringe NBA, an undrafted free agent. Like, people are trying to get themselves to Toronto, and I think that we're going to start seeing that filter in at the higher levels as well when they realize, like, wow, that's a team that has its whole thing together. It knows what it's doing, and it's not going to make decisions that are going to hamper my ability to win. And I think that all sort of leads to guys like Fred VanVleet, you know, pretty easily re-upping. It didn't even seem like it was that much of a question. I know Raptors fans, because of that longstanding trauma, got pretty worried for a second there, and you're looking at the teams around, and it's like, oh, no, the Knicks are going to give the Godfather offer. What are they going to do? And it just kind of always seemed like it was pretty rote and that Fred was going to come back. I always felt pretty good about it just because of that relationship and the way they've always talked about Fred and keeping their own guys and taking care of their own guys. So, yeah, it's just the further evolution of the franchise that, you know, it's almost to the point now we can't even really talk that much about the tortured history. They've been good for 8 years now, or 7 years, whatever it's been, and they're going to be good again this year. And at this point, you just have to accept that, like, bygone era of being the place that everybody wants to leave as soon as they can it's just not the case anymore. People know what Toronto's about and know it's a franchise that they can sort of hitch their wagons to, and we're seeing it now, most recently, the former Fred sticking around.
Well, and Sean, Fred sticking around, Dewan Hernandez will not. He was released, non-guaranteed contract, became fully guaranteed on Sunday, not super noteworthy of any means, but certainly a roster change. But Terrence Davis, the decision on him, you have the charges that he's facing as well, very serious. And his contract, I believe, becomes guaranteed on Sunday also. What do you think the Raptors do with Terrence Davis?
It's hard to say. I mean, I'm on record on my own podcast, I think on this station last time I was on, saying I don't think Terrence Davis should be on the Raptors anymore. Look, I understand on some level the people who scream out, oh, due process, due process. Look, that's for a court of law. Like, this is not a court of law. This is a basketball team. And, you know, teams have released players for far less reasons than what Terrence Davis would be released for by Sunday if they don't let his contract guarantee. They just released Dewan Hernandez for not being very good at basketball. And in terms of Terrence Davis, I mean, the charges are serious enough. And the police report is disturbing enough to me that you just wash your hands with him and say, you know what, you know, maybe he gets a second chance somewhere else, but it's not going to be here. And I think that's totally fine, and I think that's what the Raptors should do. I don't think that's going to be what happens because, you know, they're going to wait and see. Terrence Davis is good enough. Unfortunately, as we see with these cases, it's not how it should work by any means. You know, it shouldn't matter how good a player is. If they do something that's worthy of being booted off the team, they should be booted off the team. But, you know, you have to understand that this is what happens. And, it, you know, hopefully we can change that norm at some time. But because Terrence Davis is a good player, because he, you know, figured to, before all this happened, to be a bigger part of the rotation this season, I have a feeling the Raptors are going to kind of let this ride and see what happens. You know, the court date, I believe, in early December, and we might get some clarity as to what the process is going to be there. Does he plead guilty? Is there going to be a trial? Whatever, the charges get dropped, who knows? But I think we'll probably wait and see the Raptors, you know, just kind of hang on for now until that becomes more clear. And then if you need to waive him, he's only $1.5 million. I think they've probably made that calculus as well. It's not like it's burdensome to just cut him midway through the season, even if his contract is guaranteed. You know, again, I think there's enough there, and there's enough in terms of the severity of the allegations to me to just say he shouldn't be on the team anymore. And I'll be disappointed if he's still on the team after Sunday, but I kind of expect him to be there because at this point, I'm kind of cynical about how sports teams are going to handle this stuff. You can say you can have a no tolerance policy and you can, you know, speak on and say you have these great values, but really until you're faced with the situation on your own front, you're not really going to be able to prove that. And, you know, the Raptors are a team that once employed James Johnson after a pretty severe domestic case between his two stints with the Raptors. They signed Jared Sullinger after he's had some allegations against them as well. It's not as though the Raptors have a full-on 100% no-tolerance policy in their history. That's unfortunate. But I think because of that, I think they're probably going to ride this thing out with Davis and just see it through at least a little bit further in the legal process.
Sean Woodley is our guest from the Locked On Raptors podcast here on Sportsnet tonight with Matt Marchese and Andy McNamara. I wanted to get back to the Fred VanVleet conversation just for a little bit here.
Yeah.
We've seen what Fred has become. Listen, his development curve has been incredible from being an undrafted free agent to signing a contract that's over $80 million. It's the largest for an undrafted free agent. Like, everything that he's done, he has done the right way, and he's gone about it the right way. My question is, we've seen the growth, but what is the ceiling here? Like, can he ever be this team's best player?
I don't think he'll ever be the team's best player, and I don't think you're paying him to be that. You know, you pay a max salary for someone to be the best player, and, you know, Pascal is that right now. He's worth the max, whether he's the best player or is the second best player down the line if you can get someone to pair with him. But I think for Fred VanVleet, I mean, look, the limitations are still real. He's not a very good finisher around the basket. He still struggles against size sometimes, and he can get a little bit dribble happy on offense. And I think in a lot of ways was kind of symptomatic of a lot of the things that went wrong in that Boston series, where the offense really kind of slowed down a lot of the time when Fred was running the show, and then Kyle Lowry would get it. And he would say, all right, screw this. I'm going to score and you can't stop me. I'm going to jump into this large 7-footer in front of me and score and, you know, push this guy back 6 feet with my butt. And, you know, that's just kind of what Kyle Lowry does. I don't think Fred is necessarily going to be that kind of dynamic guy who can get a bucket anytime he wants. He still struggles with the length of defenders at the rim. And Kyle's like a kind of underratedly athletic player, and I don't know if Fred really matches those measurables. But that doesn't mean Fred can't get better. I mean, his pull-up shooting really took a step in the bubble, and I think that's an enormous thing for unlocking the game and also unlocking the driving game as well, right? Because you have defenses that really have to worry about that pull-up shot in a way maybe they didn't a year ago. So there's that. I think his defense is always going to play up. He's an incredible defender. He's one of the best on-ball defenders of point guards in the entire NBA, which is an incredible, valuable skill. And if you are the Raptors and you're looking ahead to the summer of 2021, and, you know, there's a report out today from Bleacher Report about how Giannis's chances of maybe sticking around there in Milwaukee are lower after the botching of the Bogdan Bogdanovich thing. And you think that Giannis thing is a real sort of, a thing you can actually do, then Fred fits perfectly in that theoretical team. I mean, he's a guy who doesn't have to have the ball in his hands. He can play off ball. As a Raptors writer, Jacob Mack for Raptors HQ, my site, said on Twitter, Fred is basically Klay Thompson with a Napoleon complex, and it very much applies. And that's the beautiful thing of Fred. He can play on the ball, he can play off of it. So even if he doesn't get a whole lot better than what he is right now, maybe it's a slight overpay at $21 million a year, but I really don't think so. And yeah, I think there will be incremental improvements in potentially the finishing, in the pull-up shooting, and just in the way he orchestrates the offense in a bit more of a direct way. And if that's the case, and he's your third or fourth best player, That's fine. You can pay a guy $20 million to be the fourth best player on an excellent team. And I kind of think even right now he's probably the fourth best player. I'd probably take OG ahead of him just because of OG's defense and his versatility. But that's kind of a toss-up to me. I'm not upset about what Fred's making, though, if that's the question. I think he's perfectly, maybe a little bit overpaid for what he's done so far, but you're also paying for what's to come. And I think we're the best for Fred VanVleet is still to come.
Sean, if we move to this very short off season, okay, usually we have more time for Raptors fans to get upset about the power rankings that come out from U.S. media, the over-under win total, and the disrespect, Sean, the disrespect we always get and get fired up about. 41.5 is the line, over-under win total for the Raptors this year. You're taking the over, the under. My first thing I see that, I say, that's ridiculous. If I wasn't so cheap, I'd put some bucks on the over. I would take that over all day, 41.5. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's the Raptors. Take the over. They've hit the over like 8 years in a row. Like it's
right.
They're going to win a lot of games. They're going to surprise people. They're going to overachieve because people still don't really realize that Kyle Lowry drives winning like maybe five other players in the entire league have for the last decade. And, you know, I think people who've watched Kyle Lowry know that a Kyle Lowry run team is going to win a lot of games, and it's not a surprise by any means. And those on the outside, it still is a bit of a shocker whenever the Raptors quote unquote overachieve. You know, I think they might be a little bit worse than they were last year. Do I think they're going to have the best ever win percentage in franchise history? Probably not. But I do think the team, like the top four of the team, is still very good. You have Norm coming off the bench. Center is, as we talked about last time I was on, Andy, like it's a mercenary position. You can make it work with your centers, especially when you have the infrastructure the Raptors have to sort of conceal their centers and not have them overexposed and having to do too much. And this is just a team that knows how to win games. It's a team that tries really hard. And there's something to be said for trying really hard on random Wednesday nights in January when nobody cares. And so, yeah, do I think they have like a higher ceiling than last year? No, I think it's probably a touch lower. Like I wouldn't bet on them being a finals team or anything like that, where they very easily could have made it to the finals if a couple things break right for them this year. But they also could be a finals team. It's just a smaller chance. Like they're very good. They have a chance to make some moves at the deadline as well because of the contracts they now have on the books, and Aaron Baines and Chris Boucher, and Norm isn't expiring potentially if he's going to opt out at the end of the season, which seems like it might be likely. You know, they have some stuff to package to really get an upgrade as well, which will only increase the win total. But yeah, 41 seems very low to me. I'd project them probably somewhere around 47, 48 in this shortened season, and I won't be surprised if they shoot past that because they always win a lot of games. That's just what they do. And until Kyle Lowry is no longer on the team, he's going to drag them kicking and screaming to 50 wins. And I feel like that's pretty comfortable to say.
You know, it's really funny that, you know, you talk about how people perceive them to be overachieving and overachieving. At some point when you quote unquote overachieve so much. Maybe you're just good. Like that's kind of, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, oh yeah, you know, they overachieved. They won 55 games. Nobody was expecting that. Hey, they won 56 games this year. What a coincidence. Yeah, they're a good basketball team. And the one thing that nobody seems to remember is that they have the reigning coach of the year. This team, the nucleus that is left, especially their younger nucleus, has an NBA championship, and the coach just finds ways to win. He finds ways to get the best out of his players. Not only that, the guys that they have brought in will give you some, they're good depth pieces, and they have maybe these guys like a DeAndre Bembry, who is a first round pick, and Alex Len, who is also a high first round pick, have underachieved in their careers. We've seen the development of players in the Raptors system since Masai Ujiri has taken over. Maybe these guys come here and quote unquote overachieve, and this team is a lot better than people think.
Yeah, I was sort of thinking about this. I was doing a bit of a thought exercise a couple of days ago and thinking back to the 2017-18 team, the culture reset team, where they won 59 games. They almost won 60, if not for Bam Adebayo's very broad shoulder. And, you know, that was an incredible team, and the run was unbelievable. Obviously, they fell short in the postseason because they had very real limitations on defense, but like that was an excellent, excellent team with some outstanding, you know, advanced metrics to back it up. And I was looking at that roster and thinking, is it that much better than this year's roster? Like, you know, you have OG Anunoby was a rookie that season. He's going to be like the third evolution Pokemon version of OG Anunoby this year. He's like so much better than he was as a rookie and is only going to improve this season. Pascal Siakam was like a 20-minute a game bench guy on that team. And now I think you could argue that he is kind of better than DeMar DeRozan ever really was because of the defense he brings. When his offense isn't there, you know, there were plenty of times in the postseason where Pascal's offense was bad enough that if he didn't offer transcendent defense, he'd be off the floor in the way that DeMar would be. But DeMar didn't have that defense. Pascal does. And so I kind of think Pascal is like a better winning player than DeMar ever was. Yes, Kyle's a couple years older, but Fred's a much better player now. And you have a bench that, you know, Norm Powell's moved along. He's an improved player. You have Alex Len and Aaron Baines. And, you know, they had Serge Ibaka and Jonas Valanciunas on that team, but they were starting together. And it was a weird, uncomfortable fit that never really made a ton of sense. And you also have, like you said, Nick Nurse, who's a better coach than Dwayne Casey. Like, I love Dwayne Casey, but Nick Nurse is an incredible coach who can milk a lot out of a team. And I just kind of think, like, it's not that crazy to say that this roster is, if not as good, very, very minimally less good than that 2017-18 roster. And that team won 59 games. Yes, the East was probably a little bit more easy then. And if there's going to be something that inhibits the Raptors from really shooting that over by a bunch, it might just be that there's a ton of very good teams at the top of the East. There's six excellent teams that are just going to beat the hell out of each other all season long. But there's also a lot of bad teams that they're going to beat up on too. And so, yeah, it's to me, betting against the Raptors, I'm going to not do that until they prove me wrong. Like, I'll just assume they're going to hit the over. It's kind of like the Spurs, right? No one picked the Spurs to miss the playoffs until they missed the playoffs. And now it's okay to say they're going to miss the playoffs. But it's just they've built up so much equity now over the last 7 years and so much, I think, expectation that they are going to come out and perform a little bit higher than what the sort of, you know, the experts might say, that you just have to accept that they're probably going to do it now, regardless of the roster. And I don't think the roster is all that bad.
Well, and Sean, what I think maybe some of the, you know, U.S. national media, whatever, might overlook is this team, you touched on it, hasn't, like, all these key parts, they're not at their ceiling, right? Like, these are still players ascending. Pascal's still ascending. OG's still ascending. And so what do you want to see, or maybe what should Raptors fans hope for or expect in their development coming into this year? Because if they keep getting better, which we expect, if they take another step forward, it's not quite the same as, you know, you bring in a new guy, of course, but if you get extended play from guys who are already familiar in your system, that's invaluable. You're not paying any extra for that.
Yeah, totally. I think that's a big reason why I'm kind of bullish on this team, is I think there's going to be a lot of growth, in particular from OG and Siakam. I mean, look, Pascal had a rough postseason. There's no denying that. He was very, very, very bad. And he knows that. Everybody knows that. But he's also a guy who 2 years ago, as I said, was a 20-minute-a-game bench guy who was scoring 7 points a game. he has made a once-in-a-generation improvement every year since he came in the league. We've never seen an arc like this. And I'm not expecting that once-in-a-generation arc to just fizzle out after 4 years. I'm expecting him to improve upon the things that led him down in the postseason. I would imagine he's going to get stronger. I would imagine he's going to work on the pull-up three. He's going to work on his mid-range game. He's going to work on the finishing around the basket, which it's not like he's never been a good finisher around the basket. I remember in that year where he was in his second season, and also in his third season when he was like the third banana on that very good team behind Kyle and Kawhi that won the title, like he was scoring literally everything from like 8 feet, all those weird off glass layups. Like that was like his shot. And that kind of went away last season, I think, with the extra burden of everything he was carrying. But we know that shot's in his repertoire. And if he gets that back, I mean, they win that series against Boston pretty handily and they probably go to the finals. So yeah, I think Pascal is going to make a big growth. I think he's going to refine the things that let him down and sort of take the lessons of the postseason. And then OG, I mean, I'm really, really excited about OG. I was talking to a fellow Raptors writer, Joe Wolfon, from The Score this week, and he pointed out, like, you know, the ceiling for OG is like prime Ron Artest. And if you don't remember prime Ron Artest, that dude was a monster. He was a 20-point-a-game scorer who was the best defender on earth. And I think OG kind of has that potential, especially on defense. I mean, if I had to pick what my all-NBA, all-defense teams are going to be before the season, OG would be a lock for me. I mean, he should have been on the team last year. He was the best defender on the Raptors. And I think this year he's going to be tasked with playing center a lot, and he's going to get to flash the defensive chops a little bit, maybe add some block totals and things like that to the numbers to beef him up. And I just think he's probably the best wing defender on the planet right now, and that's going to get recognized, I think, this year as – you know, he was very close last year to making it. I feel like the all defense teams, it's always kind of like a year late. So I'd expect he's going to get his due. And on offense, I mean, we saw in the postseason, he's a far more confident player with the ball in his hands. He's got that like very bullying post-up game where he can kind of just improvise a post-up out of anything and score on somebody. He's a wonderful cutter. We know all the things he does well. In addition to the three-point shooting, which has always been good, I think OG stands the chance, but maybe not to be an all-star this year, but to be like one of the more high-end sort of quote-unquote role players. That's not even doing it justice. I think he's going to be more than that, but he'll be like a maybe not an all-star, but a fringy type. Oh, maybe he's like the fourth injury replacement type guy this year. I really do think there's going to be a big jump for him, and that is, again, a big reason why I'm pretty bullish on what this Raptors team can do in the regular season. Postseason, we'll see. They still might not have the creation to kind of navigate a postseason series against really good defenses, but I think the regular season is going to be kind of easy for this team to rack up wins.
Sean, just one quick one before we let you go. We talked about Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby. Which of the two is it more important for them to take the next big step? Is it OG or is it Pascal for the success of this team?
That's interesting. I'd probably say Pascal because, you know, you saw the lack of him being able to create his own shot in the playoffs really hurt the Raptors, and they were relying too much on 2 6-foot guards. If you have that extra presence from the wing who can, you know, at 6'9", create his own shot and not turn it over when he tries to do a spin move that everybody knows is coming, you know, that's going to be a game changer. He, you know, he runs the floor with reckless abandon. We know he's good at that. We know he's good sort of working off of a guard, but if he can do stuff on his own, that is an absolute game changer for the Raptors. And I think there will be some steps there taken. I think that's probably the thing he's been working on the most this year because it's what let him down the most. And if he can make that step, the Raptors have themselves a prime go-to scoring option, which is what every team needs. Every team is thirsting for in the postseason, and that could really change the ceiling if he takes another big step from where he was last year, which is a lot to ask, of course, but he took an enormous step last year with like kind of no seasoning as to how to do the job of being a number one. And I think in year two of it, he's just going to become that much more refined and that much more dangerous for other defenses to deal with.
Sean, thank you so much for your time. Great stuff as always. And hopefully we'll get to chat again soon.
Of course, guys. Have a good one.
Sean Woodley from the Locked On Raptors podcast, our guest. We're going to take a break. Coming up after the break, some more news regarding the Ravens and Steelers game, which is supposed to happen on Sunday, which was supposed to happen tonight. We'll have more on that. And, of course, text in 590-590 for your chance to win Andy's Pizza. That's all coming up on Sportsnet tonight. You're listening on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right. When somebody screws up so badly that it causes a cluster bleep across the NFL, somebody's got to get fired. Right, Andy? Like, somebody's got to get the axe. So, you're listening to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. By the way, I'm Matt Marchese, and alongside me is Andy McNamara. Okay, so if I'm getting this straight, the Ravens are not going to be allowed back into their facility until Monday.
Yeah.
The game is supposed to happen Sunday. That's not going to happen.
No. Which was supposed to be today.
Yeah, it was supposed to be today. So now we're going to get pushed back twice. So that game was supposed to happen tonight. It's not going to happen Sunday. They'll probably push it to Tuesday. But then it causes another problem because the Ravens are supposed to play the Cowboys on Thursday, and that'll probably get pushed to Sunday or Monday the following week. If you're following along at home, that strength and conditioning coach should be on his ass on the sidewalk, fired.
Yes, and named. He should be shamed. Have the old Games of Thrones. Ding, ding, ding. Shame.
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 Yes.
Walk through the streets and shamed. That's disgusting. And you know what? The Ravens themselves, the whole organization top to bottom. What? No one noticed this dude was walking around without a mask?
Yeah,
like, okay, the guy's an idiot, obviously. But what about everybody else? Now, and you know what? I hate the Ravens even more for this because they're making me stick up for the Pittsburgh Steelers. I don't want to do that. But this is a case, Matt, where the Steelers, from what we've seen, have done everything right. Everything right. They got hosed by the Titans. They're getting screwed again. Why is the league bending over backwards for the Baltimore Ravens? You have an extended practice squad. That's why the league put that in. You have backup quarterback. Toss in RG3. You're not going to have your full complement, Ravens. You're not going to have the guys you want. Too freaking bad. Too bad. You're done. You should be fined. You should have draft picks taken away. And you should have to play with a skeleton backup squad if it's just to send a message. Too bad for you. And that's what it should be, but it doesn't look like. They're going to bend over backwards so that Lamar, your reigning MVP and poster boy, can play. It's disgusting.
I know your hatred runs deep.
Fired.
But I'll take a more measured approach to this. The only reason why I can see them pushing the game is that they continue to get positive tests. That's the issue. If nobody had tested positive today, then that game goes as planned on Sunday. The concern was that, you know, yesterday, I think, if I'm not mistaken, somebody else tested positive yesterday, and that's why they pushed there was the concern, and they pushed this game. So obviously, if they had played tonight, Steelers players could have come in contact with others who have COVID-19, and then that would have caused another bleep storm. So I kind of get where they're going with this. If for the next 2 days that nobody tests positive, then that's a different story. But we'll see what happens. We actually had a texter, Alex in Brockville, said, the Packers got to take advantage of the 49ers because of COVID and injuries. Why don't the Steelers get to play their game? Serious, double standard. Not fair for the Steelers. Alex must be a Steelers fan. Or he's a Browns fan like yourself.
But it's a great point, Matt. The 49ers, why? Because the MVP didn't have COVID. It was lesser known guys. Like, to me, I don't know if that's the case. If I'm a fan of those teams or just an onlooker, that's what it looks like to me. And I get you with the players. You don't want to put the other team who's doing things right in danger. But that's why they had these rules. That's why they had these extended practice squads. Okay, who's not positive? Well, you're in. Too bad. You got to deal with it. And maybe that'll help smarten you up when you get your butts kicked by the Pittsburgh Steelers and get embarrassed for being the joke organization that you've become from dealing with situations like this. It's just terrible when other teams have to suffer for how those clubs that don't follow the rules just get away with it.
I will tell you this. I did not test positive for COVID-19. I've barely left my house, but I am positive that it is time to win some of Andy's pizza.
Yeah, there you go, baby. Let's go. Okay, I'm back into good headspace here. I think you're going to say you're positive Andy's going to have a heart attack on the air because I'm feeling hot. Hot like some Domino's pizza. All right, so here's what we got. Now, Matt, you are in a good situation for some redemption because Tuesday you played, who was it? Josh somewhere.
Boffle.
Josh from...
Yeah, Josh in, where was Josh?
Pickering?
Yes, Pickering.
Pickering.
Sorry,
so you
Josh.
Played producer Mark Boffo. You failed Josh. Okay, Sean won from Markham or Thornhill, wherever it was, for Boffo. So here's how it works, okay? We're going to play some dramatic music. We're going to do it the Family Feud style, the fast money. So I'm going to put 2 minutes on the clock. We're going to have the music. I'm going to ask you each 10 questions. Whoever gets the most questions right during that time period wins their texter some Domino's pizza, a Domino's pizza prize. If you don't know an answer, press or say pass. And it's really to your benefit to just answer all questions, because if it's a tie, whoever has the most time left on the clock will be decided as the winner. So we'll bring in, I guess, producer Sho Ali here too, right, Matt?
Yeah, let's bring in Sho. He's my combatant for this evening.
Ooh. Sho.
Gentlemen, I've only ever listened to this game before. I've never actually played, so I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes.
Sho, I got an idea. I'll give you an idea. You're probably going to win.
Do I also get pizza, Andy, or just our two texters?
Well, you know what? Well, I've been doing that for part of it. I want to make sure. I'll say yes for now, but I want to make sure we have enough pizza vouchers going on for the listeners first.
Yes,
okay?
Of course.
I want to take care of the listeners first. But if I do, absolutely.
Whoa. Why are we not taking care of the hosts first? Come on now.
Man. These guys pay the bills. You know, we got to take care of the people who bring the money. You know,
that's true. All right, let's rock and roll.
Let's go. So we have now who's going to be. So Jeff from Woodbine Racetrack. That's very specific. Is he at the racetrack or does he live there? I don't know. That's a very specific.
Maybe he's riding a horse.
Maybe, yeah.
Jeff is on a horse listening to us right now. Jeff, be careful. You will be represented by Matt. Tom from Rouge Hill will be represented by Sho. So, our technical director, Tom Young, can you please start the dramatic music? There we go. All right. Okay. Matt, you're going to start.
Oh.
You're playing from the guy riding the ponies. All right. Here we go. Your 2 minutes begins now. What year was the first NFL Thanksgiving game played? 1942, 1920, 1934, or 1950?
1942.
Which NFL team has the most wins on Thanksgiving Day?
I'm going to go with the Dallas Cowboys.
Who's the only NFL team with a 9-1 record right now?
The Kansas City Chiefs.
Which of these artists have performed at the most Super Bowl halftime shows? Gloria Estefan, Prince, Bruno Mars, or Michael Jackson?
I want to say Prince.
Michael Jackson was called the King of Pop. Which female singer is considered the Queen of Pop?
Of course I'm not going to get this, but I'll go with Madonna.
What was the first video played on MTV?
Oh my God. Music video?
First music video.
Beat It.
You have 50 seconds. Okay. Which of the well-known four members of the Beatles was not an original member?
Ringo.
Over or under an average of 4,000 calories are consumed per person at Thanksgiving dinner in the United States?
Oh my God, that's the hardest over I've ever hit in my life.
World Wrestling Entertainment holds their Survivor Series event around Thanksgiving each year. When was the first one? 1987, 1980, or 1992?
1987.
Who was the last WCW World Heavyweight Champion before the company was bought by Vince McMahon?
Booker T.
All right, there we go. 8 seconds remaining, Mr. Marchese. Okay, so you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six.
Ooh,
out of 10.
Surpassed my total. Surpassed my total.
Now, you started slow again. You got three out of your first four wrong, but then you really hit it strong. The ones you got wrong, the first NFL Thanksgiving game was played in 1920.
Wow.
The team with the most wins on Thanksgiving Day, the Detroit Lions, just because they've played in it, the Lions.
That's what I was thinking. It's probably the Lions, but that's they suck so bad.
Gloria Estefan has played the most Super Bowl halftime shows out of the group I listed. Three Super Bowls in the 90s she performed at. And first video played on MTV, Video Killed the Radio Star.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Right?
Great.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. That's okay. So, I bounce back.
You're pretty good. Okay. So Jeff on Woodbine Racetrack somewhere has six. That's pretty good. Show, are you ready to try to win Andy's Pizza, some Domino's Pizza prize for Tom in Rouge Hill?
As ready as I'll ever be, Tom and Andy. Tom, I'm going to preemptively apologize, but we'll give it our best shot.
Let's go. Music, please. Okay. Here we go, show. Your time starts right now. Which of these teams did not play in the first slate of NFL Thanksgiving games in 1920? Akron Pros, Canton Bulldogs, Chicago Tigers, or Kentucky Americans?
Oh, man. Did not play. Let's go with the Canton team.
The Lions have played in the most NFL Thanksgiving games. Which team has played the second most?
I'm going to say the Cowboys.
New York Jets are winless, but what is the only team with one win right now in the NFL?
Oh, gosh. I guess... the Jags, I think.
True or false, Super Bowl halftime performers do not get paid.
That is true.
What is the name of Miley Cyrus's famous dad?
Billy Ray.
R. Kelly's song, I Believe I Can Fly, was featured on the soundtrack of which famous sports movie?
Space Jam.
Which music group has sold more albums all time? The Eagles, Led Zeppelin, The Beatles, or Elvis Presley?
Wow, that's hard. I gotta guess The Beatles.
Over or under, 35 million turkeys are prepared for U.S. Thanksgiving every year.
Much like Matt, I'm going to say over for Thanksgiving.
America. At the first WWE Survivor Series main event, who won? Team Andre the Giant or Team Hulk Hogan?
Ooh, I'm going to say Hulk's team.
Who is the oldest person to win the WWE World title?
Oh my gosh. I have no idea. Pass.
That's the last one. You got to guess.
Okay. Oh, I got to guess? Okay. Stone Cold.
Okay, there we go. 22 seconds remaining. Let's count this up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Ooh,
7.
What?
Correct.
I got blitzed again?
Woo! But Matt, you know what, dude? That was a very good showing. 6 is solid with all the pressure. Show, the one you got wrong right off the bat was a tough one. The team that did not play in the first slate, like some of these old original NFL teams are hilarious. There was two teams called the Pros. That was just like, what are we? We're professionals, the Pros? Like Akron Pros, real. Canton Bulldogs, Chicago Tigers. The team was the Kentucky Americans. They did not play.
Okay.
Then you went on an absolute tear, getting right 2 through 8. And you got the two wrestling ones wrong. I'm a little disappointed.
I know, the two wrestling ones wrong. As soon as you started asking Matt wrestling questions, I'm like, oh boy, Andy's going to ask me some wrestling questions.
That's right.
I'm not in the headspace.
It was actually Team Andre the Giant who won.
Really?
His team included the late Rick Rude, Ravishing Rick Rude, King Kong Bundy, Butch Reed, and One Man Gang. And the final question, who is the oldest person to win the WWE World title? Vince McMahon at 54.
Really? Wow.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
Vince McMahon at 54.
Okay, so Andy, I needed clarification on one of mine.
Okay, got it.
Was the average amount of calories consumed by Americans over 4,000? Did I get that one right?
You got it right, and you're right to smash the overmat. The average is actually 4,500.
Oh my goodness.
And guys, smash over.
And I checked. That's not in like, oh, over the Thanksgiving weekend or over the Thanksgiving day. That is dinner. That is you sit down at the table for dinner.
Wow.
And then you gorge yourself to near death, apparently. Like, if anybody asks, I'm all for that. That's disgusting. 4,500. What do you eat? Are you drinking the gravy boat? Like, is that instead of water? Like, that's your, you're just chugging thick gravy?
Ooh. Have you ever had good gravy, Andy? Come on.
I love a good gravy. Don't get me wrong. But I actually have a friend who on a dare at a wedding chugged a gravy boat. And it was the worst $20 he said. He said the $20 was not worth it. He should have asked for more.
What's worse? What's worse, that or the cinnamon challenge? Like, I'm trying to figure out what's worse there, because it might be the gravy one.
Oh, and so, okay, take me through. I've heard of the cinnamon challenge, but what is it? Is it you have to...
Okay, you put a spoon, like a tablespoon full of cinnamon in your mouth, and you try and swallow it, and you can't, and you just cough everything up.
Oh, okay. You know what? I don't know. Like... That seems like it would be easier just because it's a smaller amount, but I guess it's obviously a thing. There's like the milk one too, but like 4,500 calories. Like,
yeah,
wow.
That's a lot.
That's America, that's USA. You know?
Yeah. Speaking of America and Thanksgiving, since we have producer Sho Ali on the line with us, so let's revisit our question for today. And it was, in honor of American Thanksgiving, which fantasy football player are you most thankful for? We've gotten an Antonio Gibson from a buddy of mine, Will Harris. We've got a Devontae Adams from our friend and technical operator on the station, Vic Palazzo. Andy, you had Justin Herbert.
Yeah.
I had another friend of mine, Brian Bailey, who says Tyler Boyd is his guy. For you guys, who do you, I got another one from another buddy, Joe Simonetti, Devontae Adams, another one. Andy, why are you thankful for Justin Herbert?
Well, I'm thankful for Justin Herbert, who, by the way, is the QB8 overall, ahead of Lamar Jackson, by the way. I'm thankful for him because I got him off of waivers in one of my leagues, okay? So I think I'm trying to remember who I started the year with. I think it was Matt Ryan. Like, I did the strategy, wait, and if things fall right, Matt Ryan's going to give you good numbers. You know, he's got Julio and all that. Didn't really work out. So I got Justin Herbert, like, right after his debut when they were still like, all right, what's this kid about? I got him. I picked him up. And now this dude is just smashing points for fantasy football. Like, the guy's the lowest he's gotten is just under 22 fantasy points since he came in, outside of his second game. He's been sensational. So I'm thankful for being able to get Justin Herbert when he was owned in like 10% of fantasy leagues, and he's helping me help me win.
All right, so who are you thankful for?
You know what? I was going to say Joe Burrow, but probably not so much anymore, unfortunately, for Joe. But I guess the second guy I would go with would be Dalvin Cook. Dalvin Cook has been just absolutely filthy. And I've told Andy this story before, Matt, but I'll tell you as well. Basically, in this particular league, this is a super flex league, okay, that I'm in with Dalvin Cook. And this particular league, I had the sixth overall pick in the draft. And the number two pick, no, the number three pick, actually, the number one, number two went McCaffrey and Barkley, as you would imagine. And the number three guy in the draft took Lamar Jackson. And because Jackson went at number three, everyone kind of moved down as well. Like, Zeke moved from three to four. And then, you know, I think Michael Thomas went next at five. And then I had my pick between Derrick Henry and Dalvin Cook, and I took Dalvin Cook. So not only am I thankful for Dalvin Cook, I guess, I'm thankful for that particular fantasy owner taking Lamar Jackson at number
right.
three.
That's
yeah,
pretty good.
Don't you just love those? I have Lamar Jackson in a few leagues, and it's just been not a tire fire because he's been decent, but it's certainly not what I expected. I actually had an offer in my inbox of Lamar Jackson for Deshaun Watson earlier this season, and I didn't take it because I looked at Lamar Jackson's playoff schedule, which is really good, and the guy that offered me the trade is in first place, and I'm right behind him in second place. We have identical records, but he has more points scored, and we probably might end up in the final against each other. So great for me. But the guy that I'm thankful for, it's very close to my heart. He's been an absolute beast this year, and he hasn't had to do it with his legs, and that is my boy, Josh Allen. No questions asked. He has been incredible this season, even with his rough mid four game stretch from week five through to week eight, where he wasn't very good because of a shoulder injury. He's been electric. As far as I remember, he is, I believe, fourth in QB scoring right now. The guy's just a monster, and he is who I am thankful for in fantasy and in real football.
So in real life.
So that's my dude. Show, thanks for playing along on Win Andy's Pizza, because you won and I'm 0-2. So congratulations.
Close
and,
though. Good job,
yeah,
guys.
And a big congratulations to Tom from Rouge Hill, who gets some of Andy's Pizza. Jeff from the racetrack, I am sorry, but I hope you win on some ponies tonight.
Keep riding, Jeff.
Yeah. Coming up after the break, there's a story out there about some idiot who wants to play one-on-one with Michael Jordan, but there's a stipulation. We're going to talk about that coming up on Sportsnet tonight. You're listening on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Andy McNamara. Okay, so when I was growing up playing hockey and playing any sport, really, I thought that my dad was pretty intense. He would do a little bit of coaching from the stands and do a lot of things. You know, I guess in a way he kind of had the right to kind of tell me what to do a little bit, because he was driving me everywhere and paying for all this stuff.
Sure.
But I didn't know intense or stupidity when it comes to sports parents until LeVar Ball came around. And let me tell you, I've seen some stupid parents growing up in the hockey world. But this guy is a complete and utter moron, as far as I'm concerned. I don't like him. I think he just blows a lot of hot air and there's nothing to it. But he has now taken the stupidity to a different level. So he was asked about the possibility of facing Michael Jordan in a one-on-one game. He told TMZ Sports he would do it, but only under one condition. And the quote is, "You're going to see me and Mike, he doesn't even call him Michael. He should be calling him Mr. Jordan, for the small price of $200 million on pay-per-view. If it's a dollar short, we're not playing." Continues the quote. Yeah, continues the quote with, "Whenever they come with $200 million, I'll be ready to put my shoes back on and give you one more game." First of all, he says one more game like we knew who he was before he was a blowhard.
Yeah. He's a never was. And I like Matt, I would argue strongly his behavior and outlandishness and outspokenness is a detriment to his children. Like, if you're a team, if it's even between one of the Ball kids and another player, you go with the other player because you don't have the headache of the father.
Yes, I 100% agree with that, because this guy is way too outspoken. Now, having said that, he was really quiet when Lonzo Ball's career started to take off a little bit while he was in LA. I wonder how much they told him just to shut up.
Yeah.
But I believe there was, in 2017, he said that he would beat Michael Jordan under any circumstance.
Yep.
So this guy is a chump. And I've heard people say that he's in terms of, like, as a father of three boys who played Division I basketball, two were very high picks in the NBA, one flamed out, that he's done well for his kids. And you can make that argument, but it doesn't make him a goof, because I think he just likes the sound of his own voice at this point.
Well, exactly. That's all it is. He's trying to hype himself, and he didn't have the talent to make it on his own, so he's using his kids. And at their detriment. Like, you have not only for teams to consider you, opposing players, they hear this dad of this rookie, this young player coming in. You don't think other teams or some other players are going to be going after them harder to make him to be like, shut your old man up. Like, there's no benefit to it. I love a good hype. You know, I love a good promo as good as anybody. But when it comes to this, and it's too much, it's just outlandish. Like, dude, you're going up against, I don't care if Michael Jordan is dead, you're not beating Michael Jordan. It's ridiculous.
Well, that leads me to my quick question before we hit our break. If the game was to 21 points, how many points does Michael Jordan win by?
I think he wins by 20 points. I think LeVar gets one. I think he gets one somewhere.
Can I tell you what I think he wins by?
What?
I think he wins by 21.
Okay.
I don't even He's think so he gets good. One. I think MJ so is good. Such a competitor that he just says, "Nah, I'm going to shut this guy up for good. He's not going to get a point
amazing.
On me."
Amazing.
Even at his age, he still does that. That's my opinion. But anyway, the end of this rant is I wish that LeVar Ball would just go away and be quiet for a little bit. We're going to be quiet for a couple minutes, but when we come back, the Jays' interest in big-name free agents seems to be spilling all over the rumor mill, and one of our very own, Shai Davidi, thinks that they're going to get one of these big fish. We're going to talk to Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic coming up very shortly, and we're going to ask her that same question. You're listening to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Hour 3 of Sportsnet tonight here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Alongside me, Andy McNamara. You can follow us on Twitter at MattSN590 and at AndyMC81. It's been a busy time for the rumor mill in Major League Baseball, specifically here in Toronto with the Blue Jays, and joining us to talk about that and a little bit more is one of our favorites, Caitlin McGrath from The Athletic. Caitlin, how are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent tonight. And, you know, we talked about it a little bit earlier in the week, but, you know, the Jays being linked to all these big names, it feels like the fan base and the media as well, we're taking these a little bit more seriously than maybe we would have in years past. Do you think that's accurate?
I think so. I think that we know the Blue Jays are pretty much in a good position when you look at financial position and then when you look at competitiveness too. So they have a pretty up-and-coming roster. We know the exciting pieces they already have, and they kind of proved, albeit in a shortened season, but they proved this year that, you know, they are competitive. They have a chance of making the playoffs. I think they see themselves as a contender. I think other teams see themselves as a contender. And then, of course, because their roster is so young, it's relatively a cheap roster. So they do have room to spend. And, you know, with the front office talking to media this year and kind of making it clear that they believe that they can go out and spend on free agents and just about, you know, taking it more seriously. I think that last year helped. They kind of were singing the same tune last year, talking about how they were going after all these different free agents and going after all these guys and really were aggressive. And I do remember a point last offseason where it was like, okay, but what's going to happen here, you know? Like, is any of this aggressiveness going to pay off? And it did, because they signed Hunch and Ryu. So I think because of that, we kind of see, like, the Blue Jays backed up their word last year, and I do think that they're trying this year to once again land that kind of high-impact guy this year.
Well, and Caitlin, the Blue Jays, like you said, have been talking to what seems like a rumor to talk with everybody, but the whole MLB process has been slow. It's been kind of dragging along, right? The whole free agent thing. And part of it is the owners crying poor and money and stuff. But how much do you think comes to the fact that, at least I think it's still a fact, that half the league doesn't know if there's going to be a DH next year? Has that been decided? Because that would make, obviously, for half the league or half of Major League Baseball a little concerned about, okay, who do I want to pick up if I have to use this DH spot if you're a National League team or I don't?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and it hasn't been decided yet. So you have a lot of half the league not knowing exactly how they're going to build their roster, and then you have some certain players out there not quite knowing what their options are yet. I think I read something about online from, you know, one of those insiders about Nelson Cruz, and he's basically not able to sign with anyone, or he doesn't want to sign with anyone until he sort of knows what the situation is going to be, because obviously he's a DH. Is he going to stay in the American League, or has his options broadened? So we don't know that yet. There's also a lot of question marks. You mentioned just owners, you know, saying that they can't spend. the pandemic is still hanging over our lives. And, of course, the season next year, we don't know exactly when the season's going to start. We don't know how many games it's going to be. We don't even actually know roster sizes. I think that's something that I haven't thought about too much, or just because we don't know. But, you know, last year or this past season, we saw rosters were expanded. So is the league going to allow up to like 28 players, or are they going to go back down to 26? That impacts the team, how they're going to build the roster, right, and build the 40-man. So a lot of question marks, and I don't know how quickly they're going to be answered. So I would expect that this offseason is going to continue to be pretty slow.
Kaylin McGrath from The Athletic is our guest here on Sportsnet tonight with Matt Marchese and Andy McNamara. Kaylin, how much of the fact that we don't know where the Blue Jays are going to play next season as of yet also weighs on free agents and their potential decision to come to Toronto, do you think?
It is a factor, because I think year in and year out, when we talk about free agents and when we talk about teams pursuing guys that they really want, location is a huge factor. Money is probably the biggest factor, I think. Term's a very big factor as well. But then you go into other aspects. There's lifestyle, there's location, there's spring training location. Some guys really like to be in Arizona because maybe their off-season home is in Arizona, or Florida because their off-season home is in Florida. So location plays a big part. So not knowing where the Blue Jays will play is going to hang over their negotiations, because, you know, players are going to be curious. I think that what the Blue Jays will say to those questions and inquiries about that is, one, it's not going to be a huge factor for a long-term deal. So if they're looking to sign a guy for 4 or 5 years, whether they'll play in Toronto next year isn't going to be a huge factor, because that guy is signing there long-term. And you know, eventually the Blue Jays are going to be back in Toronto. And the other element would be, just off of that, is if it's a one-year deal, then it becomes more of a factor, I think. Because if you're signing a one-year deal, that sort of means that you are placing a lot of importance on the next season, because presumably you want to, you know, maybe improve on your last year. You want to up your value heading into free agency the next year. So that might hang over them. So I think, you know, it really depends what they're going for. But it's hard to say right now how big of a factor it's going to be. I think once the offseason plays out and maybe we see Blue Jays kind of swing and miss on a lot of guys, then we'll have to ask the question, how much of a role did it play?
Another just a quick follow-up kind of along those lines. You mentioned Hyunjin Ryu and signing him last year. How much do you believe that other players will look at that and say, well, he was one of the bigger free agents on the market. I'm one of the bigger free agents on the market, and he had no problem going to Toronto. Maybe that's something that I should consider.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, one factor was also just he's a Scott Boras client, and you know how important that can be too. I mean, there was not always the most smooth relationship between the Blue Jays and Scott Boras, but last year it was, you know, they clearly had a good working relationship. They got a deal done with Hyunjin Ryu, and then Scott Boras was there at the press conference kind of raving about the Blue Jays and what a great organization they are and the up-and-coming team they have. So I do think signing a guy like Ryu is a factor. I think what the Blue Jays are building is a factor as well. I do think that the Blue Jays have somewhat of an advantage, I think, because some of their younger players have such a name value. I mean, you know, like Vlad Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, and Tavon Biggio, you know, they come from major league bloodlines. You just know their names. So the Blue Jays have that advantage too. I think that they just, some of their young stars are also quite well known as well. So I think it all is a factor. And I think the fact that the Blue Jays are being labeled as an aggressive team and we keep hearing them linked to some guys also probably signals to people that, you know, they're in talks and they're looking to get better. And I think if a player was to see how, you know, how eager Toronto is to build on their roster, that's another factor that could make them an intriguing place to sign.
I'm with you. And Kaitlin, we don't know the answer to this yet, but I was thinking, I wonder if we see more shorter-term deals this year, one-year deals, maybe two, and guys really, if the owners keep crying poor, and that's a part of the reason why things might be getting dragged out, owners trying to wait players out, whatever, with all the other things we just talked about that have to be sorted out with the league, I wonder if we see players like, okay, you know what? If I sign a four-year deal now at this money when people say they don't have any money, maybe I'm hurting myself longer term. I wonder if we see some shorter one- or two-year deals coming into the season.
I think so. I think that's definitely an option, one-year deals or one-year with an option deals. I think that the top-tier guys are going to get the money that they would normally get. I don't think that the top free agents will hurt too much. I think it's the middle tier and the lower tier for sure that might be, forced to sign some one-year deals. It's also a strange season to come off of because it was such a short season. So you might be talking about some players who, whether they were injured and that meant being injured for even a short amount of time, in a 60-game season, you could lose half your season, especially if your pitcher takes so much time to rehab your arm and all that. So there's a pitcher that could be coming off injury or just like a bad season because they didn't really have time to ramp up. And they might, like, a name I'm thinking of here is like James Paxton. So like he had a pretty injury plagued year, and he wasn't at his best when he was on the mound, probably because of health reasons. So he, if you're looking at a guy like him, he, in any other year, if he was coming off a good year, he's one of the top free agents. This year, maybe not so much, maybe more in the middle tier. Maybe he signs a one-year deal, resets his value, hopefully he has a good season in 2021, and then he goes back to the market and maybe gets that big deal that he wants. So I think like that type of player would be willing to sign a one-year deal. And I think you're right. I think teams will kind of sway that way, especially these teams that are kind of like maybe not trying to be super competitive and they just want to field a team next year and they're saying they don't have the money to spend. I think they're going to see a lot of one-year deals definitely into the later stages of the offseason as well.
Caitlin McGrath is our guest here on Sportsnet tonight with Matt Marchese and Andy McNamara. Shai Davidi was on the station earlier today, and he was pretty confident that the Jays were going to sign at least one of those bigger name free agents. Do you echo the same confidence, or are we kind of still in the wait and see phase here because we just don't know enough about what's going to happen next year?
I will say that I wouldn't be surprised if they end up landing someone for some of the factors that I've already indicated. Is that I do think the fact that they got Hyunjin Ryu last year kind of shows that they're willing to spend and willing to, you know, meet a big name free agent. I think that another factor is just kind of what we've been talking about, is that maybe a lot of teams aren't going to be super aggressive or really going for it this offseason, whether it's for financial reasons, they don't, there's too much uncertainty next year, they don't know if there's going to be fans, there's so many different factors, right? So maybe there's just not as competitive a marketplace. So, you know, what teams might be spending a lot, like the Mets, I think the Yankees are always going to be players, maybe the Dodgers want to make some moves, Phillies probably want, but I don't think there's a ton of teams out there. And like I said, going back to it, you're consistently hearing the Blue Jays really checking in on all these types of guys. So, I wouldn't be surprised if they land someone, just because they really are kind of spreading their target of various places. It looks like they're kind of maybe aiming for a starting pitcher, but then maybe they would also settle for George Springer or DJ LeMahieu. That would solve a big sort of defensive and offensive question mark for them as well. So I don't know who it's going to be, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see the Blue Jays land like one of the top maybe 10 free agents, maybe even better than that, maybe one of the top five. But, you know, we'll see. But I do think they're going to make some kind of major move.
Which would be amazing. Yeah, that would be just send Blue Jays fans up to that next level of excitement. Now, what about somebody? And again, the Blue Jays have been linked to so many people. Who knows what's smoke, what's not, whatever. But Brad Hand, one of the best relievers out there, is a lefty. The Jays bullpen is like, we saw a lot of depth, a lot of upside, a lot of potential there. Do you see that they could make a splash potentially in the bullpen as somebody that could come in as a closer or maybe the top guy in a committee situation?
It's not impossible. And I do think we saw some sort of report yesterday or the day before about them sort of checking in on Brad Hand. And they're going to do that. They're going to check in on everybody just because they want to see what the prices are and, you know, where the guy's interested in and all that So I think more likely, I think the higher impact they're looking for would be starting pitching, or it would be position player-wise. I think when you're talking about the bullpen and the closer and someone like Brattahand, that might be a team that is a little bit closer to competitiveness. So I think that when I look at the Blue Jays, I don't see them as like one closer away from competitiveness. I
right.
see that, or like serious competitiveness, obviously. Like I see them as a number of pieces away. So I think they have to address some other major issues, starting pitching depth and also defense and also offense first, before they maybe want to make a big splash with a closer like him, who's going to cost, I don't know how much he'll cost because obviously no one picked him up for $10 million. But, you know, he'll probably be one of the more expensive relievers on the market. And the Blue Jays, in their past, they have been sort of creative with bullpen. They like to kind of pick up guys who maybe are under the radar, or they see something that other teams don't see. And they do like what they have in their system right now. So I wouldn't say that that's priority number one, but it could be an option. Maybe if some other things fall through, or they're not able to adjust, you know, plan A or plan B, you know, maybe they do look at some relief help that could, you know, help their bullpen a lot.
Caitlin, it's been really quiet on the Trevor Bauer front across the league, really. He's a guy that kind of makes his own sound bites and his own news and press clippings, but it's been fairly quiet. Where do you think the Jays' interest level is in him? Do you think that they're really interested in him, or it's got to be on their terms in terms of, you know, monetary value? How do you rate the chances of a guy like Bauer coming to Toronto?
I don't see it happening. I don't know why. I just don't. It's kind of just a feel thing that I have. I'm not sure that, I mean, for one, he's going to have a lot of teams interested in him. He's going to be the top free agent pitcher, or he is the top free agent pitcher. And this isn't the strongest pitching class either. So teams that are really, really serious about getting a high impact starter are really just going to set their sights on him. So, you know, I think that maybe the Blue Jays might go a different route and maybe aim for a position player that makes that high impact. I think Trevor Bauer, a team really has to sort of weigh, I guess, the pros and cons of having a player like him. You said that he does attract a lot of attention. He brings that upon himself. He is outspoken. He is controversial. And I think that if you're a front office like the Blue Jays, you really have to weigh, you know, whether you want that presence in your clubhouse and whether he kind of would mesh with what they're building in Toronto. Now, interestingly, though, obviously Mark Shapiro does have a history with Trevor Bauer. He was with the Indians when they acquired him from Arizona, I believe. So there is a history there. So it's not impossible. And it would help the Blue Jays. He's a good pitcher. But, you know, I feel like they might be aiming more position player-wise to make that big impact, or simply that Trevor Bauer is going to really have his pick of teams, and he might prefer to go to another club like the Mets, who might actually be a little bit more competitive or closer to it than the Blue Jays are.
Caitlin, let's go back to the position player focus, because I'm with you. Obviously, the starting pitching is definitely a need, but if we focus on that position player group, and we look at some of the names, right? The Francisco Lindor trade a few weeks ago as a potential. And then you go, like you said, DJ LeMahieu, that's my guy. I want him. George Springer. But JT Realmuto, like the talent and great teams, you know what? If an opportunity comes, you don't turn down talent. You don't turn down arguably the best position player available this offseason. But with their situation at catcher, I know it's not ideal from the offensive side, but you still have a lot of pieces there that maybe you don't have answers to. Does bringing in somebody like a Realmuto make sense and spending the big dollars there compared to another spot of need, like maybe the outfield?
I agree. I don't see him as an ideal fit just because, I mean, as it stands right now, the Blue Jays have five catchers on their 40-man roster. That
yeah.
is probably the most in the majors. And it's not going to stay this way. That's too many catchers to have on your 40-man. Obviously, there's going to be trade pieces, or there's going to be some, you know, roster moves or shifting there. I do think that they can probably dangle some of the younger prospects, Riley Adams or Gabriel Moreno, whether that would work. I think that just going back to your initial question is, you're right. Like, the Blue Jays do have Danny Jansen. They do have Alejandro Kirk, who probably looked like he was way further along than any of us thought, right? He was previously playing in high A, and he made it to the majors this year. Obviously, there was no minors for him to play in, but he looked like he belonged. And I do think there's still some seasoning that he has to have, especially defensively. Maybe he spends a little bit of time in AAA, just seeing how the roster shakes out in spring training and whatnot. But yeah, I'm not sure that getting a front end star catcher necessarily fits with the Blue Jays. And if they could, I mean, yes, if he's the player that wants to come to you, you're going to sign a star. But I do think it makes more sense when I look at the roster to aim for the outfield or the infield.
Caitlin, just one more before we let you go. There's still no indication where the Jays are going to be playing, like we had mentioned earlier on in the interview. If the AAA season goes off, which it looks like it's going to, Buffalo is not an option. How many conversations do you think they're having about looking at another venue to play out of this season?
Yeah, so that's something that's going to be ongoing for the Blue Jays. And, you know, maybe to their benefit, they went through the process once this summer, and that was under a scramble. So they really know how to navigate it. There's lessons learned, what they went through, you know, dealing with the government, dealing with all these different factors, having alternative plans, all that kind of stuff. So they really went through it once. So the benefit right now is that, A, they have some, you know, experience to go off on how to achieve what they need to achieve. And also they have time, right? So there's a lot of time before the major league season is going to start. We really don't know how the pandemic is going to progress, but hopefully there is a vaccine being distributed, whether it's in the U.S. and then in Canada, hopefully by early 2021. And maybe the landscape will just look different. So I wouldn't be I would say that the Blue Jays are still really, really hopeful that they're playing in Toronto. And I think that but they are also realistic about it, and they know it's entirely possible that they're not going to play in Toronto because they've gone through that once, and we've just seen the Raptors denied the ability to play in Toronto. So they're well aware that it's an option to not be here, and so for that reason they do have alternative scenarios. And I think Buffalo's still in play. I think they could probably fiddle around with other locations for the AAA team. That's something that maybe could be on the table. And then there's just other locations that the Blue Jays would have considered in this past summer, and those could be in play as well. So the conversation is going to be having, I don't expect it to be a mad scramble the way it was in the summer, although who knows. But, you know, it is something that they're considering.
Caitlin, great stuff as always, and I'm sure we'll talk to you very soon. Thanks again for your time tonight. Really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Caitlin McGrath from The Athletic on all things Blue Jays. When we come back, the Canadian government is pushing to make single-game betting legal in this country. It could be absolutely massive. You're going to hear from the Honorable David Lametti and his interview from Writer's Block from earlier today. That's all coming up on Sportsnet tonight here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Tom Young with the music behind the glass tonight. I kind of wanted to let this one play out a little bit. I'm a big fan. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, Tom, let it ride a little bit. Just going off on this song, there are a select few that could be, yes, they could be back in the high life again as it pertains to gambling in this country. The Canadian government, specifically Minister David Lametti, who is the Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, they introduced a bill today proposing the decriminalization of single-game sports betting here in Canada, which is an absolutely massive, massive business for this country, especially considering the economic downfalls that we've had during COVID. Why this wasn't done years ago, I have no idea. But here is Minister David Lametti for earlier today on Writer's Block, chatting about this proposed bill.
The man who introduced the bill today proposing the decriminalization of single-game sports betting is the Honorable David Lametti. He is Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, and we're very pleased that he joins us on Writer's Block. Mr. Lametti, thank you so much for joining us. We greatly appreciate your time. I imagine a hectic time for every minister.
It is indeed, but it's a pleasure to be here, guys.
So a simple question for you. Why is now the right time for this bill to be introduced, and how do you think it'll get through the Commons and eventually into the Senate?
Well, I think we'll be able to get it through the Commons quickly. I think there's a great deal of all party support on it, and that's why the timing now is right. I was following the progress of the bill. It was a private member's bill from a Conservative member. Previously, it had been an NDP member in the previous parliament, and there are a lot of Liberal MPs in Niagara. I was born in Niagara, by the way, and Windsor who were keen on it. So there was all party support. The situation in the United States with the Supreme Court decision legalizing single sport betting, and then the fact that a couple of major sports leagues dropped their opposition to it and it started to embrace it, meant if we don't do this now, we're going to lose out. And so we need to address that imbalance. It's really important to places like Niagara Falls and Windsor, amongst others, and the potential for other kinds of betting venues is I think quite great. So we're going to let the provinces and territories work out their own systems. That's the change we made. We made a change to the criminal code that will allow the provinces to do that, and we think this will be positive. Displace the you know $10 billion illegal market and the $4 billion overseas market. Hopefully we can displace the illegal and get back some of the overseas. And that's an economic driver. And the other thing is, when it's transparent, it's in the open. If we're worried about addiction problems, we can better identify. We can better program. We already work with the provinces on problematic addictions. And the other thing I want to stress is that I'm going to start consultations with Indigenous communities across Canada. They have a role in gaming in some provinces, like Saskatchewan being the main one. And so we want to hear what they have to say about this too.
David, how much of the momentum for this has to do with the fact that the morality or the moral questions that used to be surrounding this, where people would consider it a vice or, you know, people would be against it, has seemingly dissipated, and certainly dissipated in the United States, where you're seeing more individual states provide legalized sports gambling. We know Las Vegas has it. And so I just wonder if so much of this is sort of just how a general public thinks about sports betting in 2020 versus maybe how that same public might have thought about it in 1990 or 1995.
Well, this is great. I think this is, you know, I get the best question on this on a sports show. I think this is fantastic. I think you're right that there has been more of an acceptance, a change in the morality, if you will. There are still questions that we need to answer about gambling addiction, and I think we address that. But it does happen, and people enjoy it. Some people. I'm not a huge bettor, but I've gone to the track a few times in Fort Erie when I used to live down in Port Colborne. But people like to put a bit of money down on the Super Bowl or the Grey Cup or you know the NCAA final, the NCAA tournament in basketball. So this is happening. We might as well, I think, make sure it happens in a legal way, make sure it happens in a safe way, make sure it happens in a transparent way. And I think you're right to say that it points to a shift in morality.
The Honorable David Lametti is Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada. It seems that in addition to public perception of legalized gambling, you know, as someone who has covered Major League Baseball since 1989. I mean, I can tell you there wasn't a time not so long ago where if you mentioned to the baseball commissioner that you wanted to have legalized gambling in a Major League ballpark, he'd be thrown out of his office. Now, the answer would be, okay, how soon can we make it work, and how can we assure that it's above board? I'm wondering what support you have from the various professional leagues as far as this goes.
Well, there's an openness from some leagues, and I think the rest will fall in because there is a way to do it safely. What leagues worry about, right, is match fixing and that sort of thing. You know, baseball's got a particular history, right? The Black Sox, White Sox, way back, and Shoeless Joe. But I think it's easier, quite frankly, to make sure that doesn't happen if this is out in the open. You know, if you have, let's say the province of Ontario running a legitimate single sport betting operation, it's a lot harder to throw games or do what everyone has to do because of the bets. Whereas if it's clandestine and it's all happening in the shade, that's where bad stuff happens.
Would it be your anticipation that each province would approach this differently, whether that's the amount of let's say sports books or gambling facilities that are available to perhaps like what sports one could wager on? What I'm getting at is, like, is the likelihood that how Ontario approaches this going to be different, let's say, than how Alberta approaches this?
I think that's very likely. I think each province will approach it differently, again, depending on where they feel their markets are. I've already mentioned to you, I grew up in Niagara. It's going to be really important to Ontario simply because Niagara and Windsor have casinos where they would like to offer single sports betting as part of their offerings. And it's no surprise that the push has come from MPs in the Niagara and the Windsor areas, of all political stripes. So I think every province will do it differently depending on how they see their market and where they see the potential to lie.
Minister Lametti, before we let you run, my producer tells me that you were co-captain of the Oxford hockey team and that Mark Carney, who was the former governor of the Bank of Canada as well as the Bank of England, was your teammate. Who's the better player?
Oh, Carney was way better. Carney played JV at hockey. He was a goalie, so Carney played JV at Harvard. He played one period, I think, for the big club at Harvard, and they didn't score any goals on him. So he had a pretty outstanding goals against average. I'm sort of a stay at home. In those days, we played contact, so stay at home physical defenseman. I had a decent first pass in those days. I think that's gone with age.
Well, listen, we really appreciate your time. Best of luck with the bill, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Good luck.
That was the Honorable David Lametti, Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, joining Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Writer's Block. As he laid out, this could be a really big, big, big economic boom for the country, considering that $14 billion is spread out amongst the illegal gambling markets and the offshore betting over in Europe or wherever they're based. And just to the thought of recouping some of that money and getting it back into the hands of the Canadian government should be an absolute no-brainer. When we come back, it's Hot Take Thursday. We did it on Tuesday. We're going to do it again because why the heck not? That's coming up here on Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese. Our producer tonight, actually my co-host, of course, Andy McNamara. Our producer is Sho Ali, and our technical operator this evening, keeping us on the air and keeping us off the CRTC hit list, is Tom Young. Andy, It's Thursday. We did this on Tuesday, and we're also going to welcome in producer Sho Ali here. You know what it's time for, Andy?
Yeah.
It's time for a little – it's a little hot take Thursday. Hit it, Tom. Yes, here we go. It's time for some Hot Take Thursday. And we did this on Tuesday, and we didn't have a lot of time. We kind of rushed through it, so I wanted to make sure that we got enough of these spicy, sizzling takes so that we could really digest them over the course of this block here. So, Andy, Sho, we got you on the line, right?
Yep, I'm here.
All right. Okay, so Andy, we're going to start with you. Your take on Tuesday was that the Baltimore Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson next year was going to be the fourth best quarterback in the division. What's your hot take for this Thursday evening?
Oh, man, I'm still cooling down from that hot take. Too hot almost. Too hot. But I got another one tonight. I like the Island beat. Feeling good. Now, I was going to make my hot take about the Dallas Cowboys. But, guys, I got to be honest. After seeing the end of that game, I'm that one cooled a little bit. So I've called in Omaha an audible to on the other side of that matchup. Antonio Gibson. My hot take is this. Antonio Gibson will be the best offensive player in the entire NFC East next year. You can throw in quarterbacks. You can throw in wide receivers, other running backs, whatever. Whoever's returning, he will be the best most productive, and fantasy football-wise, I don't think there's going to be a higher riser to maybe a top 3-4 pick than Antonio Gibson next year. Guys, just look at what he did, and it's one game. I don't want to hear the one game thing because he has been progressing as the season's gone on. He's gotten better. Ron Rivera said when he was drafted, he saw Antonio Gibson as a, quote, Christian McCaffrey type of weapon, and McCaffrey's one of the best players. With so few touches in college, he was a projection, but 6'2", 220, the guy can catch, he can run, he's an absolute monster, and he's only halfway through year one. Give him a proper offseason. Antonio Gibson, best player out of the whole NFC East. Let's go.
When you said he can do all those things, the one thing that kind of came to my mind was he can run, he can catch, and the line from Booby Miles' uncle in Friday Night Lights, and he can pass. One of my favorite lines of all time. Yeah, exactly. What kind of take is that? A sizzling hot take from Andy?
Ooh, so you know what? I think it might be. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you count all those other running backs that you might see. I mean, Zeke's had a down year, but will he bounce back with all the injuries? Perhaps healed for the Dallas Cowboys, possibly. Will any of the Eagles players be a little better? Possibly. But I do think it's a hot take, but I like it. I'm sure Antonio Gibson, Andy, is going to be a very popular addition to not only many teams next year, but I bet he'll be on. If you look at like the makeup of championship teams this season, I bet he's going to be on a lot of those teams.
Yeah, gotta be.
Yeah, it's true, because a lot of people would have taken him later in drafts. He certainly wasn't a guy that you were taking with a fifth round pick or anything like that. It may be in dynasty leagues, but certainly not in redraft or in keeper leagues where you're probably taking him that high. But Andy's right. It is a hot take because Ezekiel Elliott, like you said, is having an off year, and I think that's going to change. Saquon Barkley's going to come back. Miles Sanders, you expect, is going to get more of a workload. But Antonio Gibson is starting to show us what he's really made of. And tonight, he looked really, really good. Yeah. He gets the hat trick of touchdowns and really propelled that Washington offense. They're starting to figure out that they need to go through him to have any sort of success. But, Sho, now we hand it off to you. What is your hot take on this Thursday evening?
You know, I think a lot of people, it's a Raptors-related take. I feel like a lot of people, when it comes to the Raptors, losing Gasol, losing Serge Ibaka, certainly. I know they brought back Van Vliet. That's very exciting, and I think a lot of people are pleased and happy with the amount of money he's coming back for. But, you know, Lowry, a year older, possibly Norm Powell might be on the way out. He has that player option, but we'll see if he, you know, what goes on with that, if he is still on the team at the end of the season. But having said all of that, while I do think some people are outside of the market of Toronto are down on the Raptors, I think that the Raptors are going to be, at worst, the second best team in the Eastern Conference, and we will see them in the Eastern Conference Finals again next season.
Wow, I think that's a sizzling hot take, because a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, the Heat went to the NBA final last year, and the Bucks improved immensely. The Sixers got a lot better, and there's a lot of talk about a lot of teams except the Toronto Raptors, and I know people have them, you know, maybe as a top four or top five seed, but I haven't heard anybody think that they're going to be top two. So, show I give that that's a spicy take. Andy, what do you think?
I like it, man. And you know what, show? I see a path to that. I do. Because you look at how this team just continuously wins, with the fact that two of the stars that you relied on last year, you hope are going to get even better. And Pascal and OG, like, they're not at their ceiling yet. So why not? I'm with you. I think if we said that to a number of, you know, national U.S. media, they think we're nuts based on the 41.5 over-under win line, which is ridiculous. But I'm totally with you. I like it.
Yeah, it is. You know, I've heard a lot of things said about the Raptors losing Ibaka and Gasol. And the takes in that are right. Listen, they're losing some veteran leadership, and I understand that. But the core of players that they are bringing back, the guys that are important pieces on this team, have won an NBA championship. They've been there. They've done that. They've got that T-shirt. And losing those two guys, yes, it's not ideal, but, you know, for whatever you lose from Marc Gasol at the defensive end, you gain probably at the offensive end with the two guys that they brought in. Serge Ibaka was certainly not a top flight defender, but he gave you rim protection, which they are lacking a little bit. But to say that Aaron Baines is going to be a nobody is the wrong assessment, because I think he fits in really well. And Alex Len could be a really good pickup. His biggest problem is that he's a foul machine. But all in all, this is still a talented Raptors team. And if anybody thinks that Masai Ujiri is just happy with, you know, kind of just being there, I think that is the absolute wrong assessment of Masai Ujiri, because he wants to win, and he wants to win another championship in this city. I just look at it as this is the perfect opportunity, and I believe it was Fred Van Vliet who said this. You know, everybody just keeps overlooking them. Okay, great. That gives us, we could fly under the radar even more, no problem. So I like the take, show, and I'm gonna watch that one with great interest, because I really do think that the Raptors have a great opportunity ahead of them here.
Yeah, I think I'm really excited to see what the Raptors end up as. And sure, is there room for variance? Absolutely. But I think in the Masai Ujiri era, like both you guys have said, it has been an overwhelming, resounding success, no matter how you look at it. And I just, like, no one's ever going to look at the Raptors and say they don't compete, or that they quit when things are looking down, right? And I mean, even this past year, a year where I think the expectations were a little lowered, right? We got some of the best comebacks in franchise history, right? Right, like the game against the Mavericks and that game against the Pacers that I think set the consecutive win record. So, yeah, I personally think it'll be an up year and a very exciting year to be a Raptors fan.
Yeah, totally agree. So my hot take is I think it's still a little spicy despite what's been happening of late. And I know that my co-host this evening is going to be all over this take. Ooh. But the Baltimore Ravens will not make the National Football League playoffs.
Oh, more.
I don't know if that is a spicy take because of what's going on with their COVID situation, but they haven't looked like the same team. Teams have figured out how to play against Lamar Jackson, and it just seems like they are imploding at the absolute wrong time. Andy, I'm going to let you have at this one first.
Oh. Oh, boy. Matt, I want more of this. I want like the old Barney from The Simpsons where he sees the big Duff beer truck, goes, into my veins. Just put all of that. All I want more. I want more of that in me, in my veins right now. I'm totally with you. Like the smile, I take almost as much joy in seeing the Ravens and Steelers lose as I do the Browns win, because I'm insane, and that's how I'm built with all the losing the Browns have done over the years. It's made me squirrely. I'm totally with you. Look at what we're seeing here. An organization that, since they were stolen from Cleveland and got two Super Bowls, has been nothing but success and rainbows and everything wonderful. Now you have a little bit of an inkling of doubt, right? Now it's all of a sudden John Harbaugh's freaking out, people standing on the logo, not shaking hands. Lamar Jackson saying, people don't want us to win. Yeah, Lamar, because you were really cocky and you're the reigning MVP and people want to beat you. In the preseason, people said, how do they beat you? And he said, you can't. Well, I think we're seeing how you can, and it's to make you throw. I will say this until the end of Lamar Jackson's career, gentlemen. If a defense's strategy is to make an opposing quarterback throw, that's not your franchise quarterback. And that's what is going to limit this team, and that is what is going to keep them out of the playoffs. I hope, Matt, you are right. And now I'm going to take a breath.
I knew you were going to need a breath after that one. Joe, what do you think about that take? Am I crazy or am I kind of right on board here?
It's funny, right? Because I think you're right, but does that mean it's not a hot take because I think you're right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. Like, I think
the consensus.
Yeah, I think the consensus. I think the consensus would be that they don't. That they do make the playoffs.
I guess that's fair. That is fair. Okay, then they're right. It is a hot take because you're right. I think the consensus is that they would make the playoffs. But I agree with you, Matt. They have looked so abysmal. And even just looking beyond Lamar Jackson, right? You look at everything going on with the Ravens. They've had a multitude of injuries at every level on their defense. It's not as good as partly because of injury, maybe partly because of scheme, but not as good as we thought they would be throughout the season. Certainly not as good as they were at the very beginning of the season. Christian has set in. Then you have all the Lamar Jackson stuff you guys just talked about. Yeah, I know. It's dry. I'm on board with you, Matt. I think the Ravens are going to miss the playoffs, and it's going to be a bit of a hand over the panic button in Baltimore a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, and I wonder, like, with everything that's going on, like, I don't know. I don't think John Harbaugh is going to lose his job because he's had a lot of success with the Ravens, but there at least has to be the question, well, there's accountability issues right now, of course, with that organization. And they are, generally speaking, a very well-run organization, but there's clearly some discipline issues when it comes to staff members. And the team just looks lost offensively. And I don't know how much of that is on Greg Roman and creativity. I think he's a pretty creative guy. But I also don't know how much of it is on Lamar Jackson. Maybe he's just not that great. I know he's not a great passer, but teams are starting to figure that out, and mm-hmm. that's not a recipe for success in a league that is very much a passing league. Boys, thank you very much for your hot takes tonight. They were spicy, as I expected. And I'm sure we will do it again soon because, you know, there's only NFL football right now. So we'll have plenty of time to think about some hot, spicy takes. Coming up after the break, we got some more NBA talk. We're going to chat a little bit about the Raptors. The Rockets are looking at moving Russell Westbrook, and he might end up in New York with the Knicks. Oh, please, please, please give me that storyline all day. We're going to talk about all that and more with John Chick, NBA writer for The Score. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, and alongside me, my co-host, Andy McNamara. The NBA offseason is usually pretty interesting, but this season, because of the short turnaround, and we certainly just finished watching NBA basketball, and the quick offseason, It's taken interesting to a totally different level. And to discuss that and a little bit more is John Chick, NBA writer for The Score. John, how are you tonight?
Hey, what's up, guys? How you doing?
We're good. We're good. I wanted to start off with the Raptors here before we kind of take a longer look at the rest of the NBA. But I asked this question earlier. The Raptors re-signing Fred VanVleet, doesn't that have to be viewed as a win for the organization? Just because we've seen so many players, you know, leave the organization or, you know, shun the organization or just not even pay attention to them when it comes to free agency. Like, Fred VanVleet had the opportunity to leave and he decided to stay.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good sign, and I don't know, honestly, how many other options he had. Like, you know, people talked about a Godfather deal from the Knicks if they were willing to go in that direction. There weren't a ton of other teams out there that had the cap space. So going into this, I think a lot of us kind of figured that if the Raps ballparked it in that four-year, $80 million range, that would probably be enough to do it, and he's earned it. He's 26, and you know, they hit unrestricted free agency at 26. That's not bad at all for him. So, and let's not forget too, the culture of the Raptors have built in the last couple of years and all that. He was obviously part of a championship, but there's some ancillary revenue that he can make here in Toronto too. He's working on branding and that sort of thing. So, I think it was a good move for him. I think he still wants to be in a contending team. If he had taken, say, more money from the Detroit Pistons or the New York Knicks, he would have been, you know, knee deep in a rebuild. So I don't think it was shocking, but I think it's certainly good.
And so, John, when we look at, okay, you got Fred VanVleet, that was the big dog, check, you get that out. Now you lose Ibaka, you lose Gasol, and then you bring in a couple of veterans, right? You bring in a couple of big men. You got Baines and Len. When you look at the type of contract and the type of player that they can be, certainly the ceiling isn't as high necessarily, I don't think, as the guys who have left. But maybe the floor is fine, and they're on 1 and 2 year deals, so it seems like it's at least flexible and maybe a good fit. What do you think of those two sort of lesser profile signings?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think. I mean, I think that I don't think anybody anticipated the Raptors to re-sign both Ibaka and Gasol. I mean, I think most people expected maybe one of them. For what it didn't happen, it shouldn't be considered really that surprising. But to get Baines, who was probably the best stopgap big man left on the market, they did pretty well there. And again, on a one-year deal with no guarantee in the second year. And Alex Len, again, too, who's a guy who, you know, was a lottery pick at one point and had some game, and, you know, be nice to see what he can do. They filled the gaps in a year where, you know, I think we can honestly say that they're probably not going to contend for a championship. I mean, they're still going to be a playoff team. They seem to be focusing more on 21, wherever that goes. We don't know yet, but given the circumstances, I think the Bain signing especially was really good.
John Chick from The Score is our guest here on Sportsnet tonight. So I wanted to take a look at some other storylines across the NBA, and the one big one is the Houston Rockets, and James Harden at first said he was committed to the Rockets, and now all of a sudden he's not. And he wants to go elsewhere, and Russell Westbrook wants out. Now, the one thing that we have seen manifest is Russell Westbrook to the Knicks. And I can't see a marriage that could be any worse than that one. That is like Britney Spears, Kevin Federline to a totally different level here. Like, it is awful, and I'm here for it. Where do you sit with that one?
Yeah, you kind of just nailed it. I mean, it's a terrible idea, but we can actually kind of get behind it in a way because it's the Knicks. I don't know how realistic it is. I mean that one's been out there because it's the Knicks. I think they might have showed some restraint maybe in the last week from what we've seen. Obviously, we're not behind the scenes and all that, but like just the way they kind of behaved at the draft, which was actually kind of smart, by obtaining some more future picks, even though they're second rounders and that sort of thing. I kind of maybe think that maybe Tom Thibodeau, being a coach, might be looking at that idea and saying, oh, hold on a second. Like, I know that the idea of getting Russell Westbrook in Madison Square Garden might be, you know, a theatrical thing. And, you know, it might put him back on a map, so to speak, but it's not necessarily going to make him a better team. So I don't know. I think the Rockets situation is, with all that stuff came out basically right before free agency, it looked like that team was totally ready to fall apart. But by all accounts, it sounds now like the Rockets are going to try and hold them both to this. I mean, I think ideally they would love to trade Russell Westbrook. I just don't know how possible that is.
But, you know, it might be a situation where James Harden's going to either have to adapt, or he could see a really ugly situation where, you know, he's not engaged. I don't know if he would hold out, but it could turn into a situation that could be bad. Their signings away from that, though, getting Christian Wood and even DeMarcus Cousins actually aren't that bad for that organization. I just don't know. It's kind of a wild card what the Rockets are going to look like.
John, usually we have a lot more time in the offseason to mull over how the Raptors are slighted by different media outlets, right, as far as power rankings, win totals. We chatted about it a little bit earlier, but I want to get your take on it. 41.5. Come on now. Like, I'm taking the over all day, and if I could make a bet right now, I would. Like, that just seems like a ridiculous total for a team that just keeps winning. Like, and there's not, even though the East is better, like, there's nothing to point to why they would fall off that much, at least to me.
Well, the first thing that when I saw that was, I'm like, I got to keep in mind it's 72 games. So,
yes.
40, what was it, 41, 42? Yeah, I mean, always bet the over with the Raps. I think they've taught us that the last couple of years. And I mean, they've really kind of shown, especially the American media, who's kind of written them off, especially last season, you know, what the team was made of. But I think it's over. I don't think it's a ton over, though. You can always kind of expect, if you're looking at ESPN or some of the other guys making these picks in the States, that it might be a couple games back too low. But, yeah, I would, you know, in a 72-game season, I would maybe put it at, you know, 45 tops. I mean, I think, you know, they're still in that upper tier of the Eastern Conference. There's no doubt about that. I don't think you can take anything away from them there. The other teams in the conference, you know, did they really improve leaps and bounds better? We know with the Nets are going to be a different team, but I mean, the Bucks adding Drew Holiday is a big move, but I don't know, are they really championship contenders? The Celtics lost Gordon Hayward, so they're going to be in the thick of it no matter what. And I would take the over, but I wasn't as offended, I think, as a lot of people were.
John, the Giannis Antetokounmpo lack of Supermax signing right now seems to be at least in the back of the minds of plenty of general managers and owners and fans alike. There's been this notion that maybe Giannis signs this Supermax, and if things go south in Milwaukee, that he decides, you know what, I want out, and at least I've got my money. Do you think that could happen if he signs the Supermax and then says, nah, you know what, I don't want to stay here?
Yeah, I think it's totally possible. I think that might actually be something that happens. I mean, it's tough to find. I was trying to think of a really comparable situation the last couple of years. Only one I could come up with off the top of my head was Paul George. Nobody expected him to re-sign with the Oklahoma City Thunder, being a small market. He's from L.A. Everybody figured he was going to Los Angeles. But he signed with the Thunder, and then when everything changed and Kawhi Leonard came calling and said, you wanted to do this super team thing in L.A., it was a matter of just saying, yeah. I mean, and the Thunder were obviously amenable to making that deal happen because of the haul of draft picks they got. But, you know, I can't say I know what's going on in Giannis and in the Kumpo's head, but I think as a guy who was drafted by the Bucks, he might give them, you know, that kind of, you know, at least a bit of a heads up, you know, where he's going to commit to the team for 5 years after this coming season. But, you know, if things go sideways and the team isn't contending, you know, can he do me a favor and trade me? And, you know, they're not left with nothing in that situation. I don't think the Bucks are in an enviable situation trying to build a team around him. I think they messed that up with the Bogdan Bogdanovich fiasco. But, yeah, I do think that's a possibility. I think that, you know, these max salaries have had all kinds of, like, a different effect on free agency and whether players stay in markets. But there is the reality that players get traded in the NBA and superstars get traded, and, like, 2 years is an eternity. So he could re-up, you know, this week, and then, you know, 2022-23, you know, he could get traded.
And that's a great point, John. And you mentioned the Paul George situation. Well, the haul that the Thunder got from the Clippers, now all of a sudden, this is the year, right? Like, this is the, okay, if Kawhi and George don't do it with the Clippers this season, everything's up in the air. There's nothing to say one or both won't leave, won't re-sign, won't whatever. And then the Clippers are left holding nothing, right? Like, yeah. how important is this year for the Clippers? They got to be freaking out over there.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of what they've done, to be honest.
No.
With you. I mean, I think getting Serge Ibaka was certainly a good signing. They lost Montrezl Harrell. I mean, I think Ibaka, in a lot of ways, is better in that area. But, I mean, they still don't really have a point guard. I expect there has to be another move. But like you just said, I don't know who are you moving at this point. If you're not moving Kawhi or Paul George, your only real trade asset is Lou Williams. I don't know what he's fetching you in the way of like a starting caliber point guard. But there's a lot of question marks for that team. And when those guys signed that deal last summer in 2019, we were saying at the time, I mean, yeah, this thing could just blow up in their face in 2021. And, you know, this is the season, right? So, yeah, I mean, they're still near the top of the Western Conference, but they're going to have to really show something in the playoffs. And they're going to have to make another move, I think.
John Chick is our guest NBA writer from The Score here on Sportsnet tonight. John, the Klay Thompson injury to me was, and not that I'm no Warriors fan by any stretch of the imagination, but I do like to see good basketball, and I'm not even a big Klay Thompson fan, but I look at that injury, the Achilles injury, and how devastating it was, because I looked at that Golden State team, and with you know, Steph Curry back healthy, Draymond's game you would think would improve from what it was last year just because he would have his running mates back. I think Andrew Wiggins was a really good acquisition by them, and then they had the second overall pick. Before all this happened, I really thought that the Warriors were in contention to be the best team in the Western Conference. Where do they sit now without Klay Thompson?
Yeah, I agree with you. That was a devastating blow. Like you said, I thought going into the season, if they were all healthy, they were a potential number one seed in the West. It'd be like this aberration of a season that we just finished never happened to them because they obviously had all those injuries. But this totally changes the game. And I think that, I think they're kind of a wild card. I mean, they could really be anywhere from third to sixth in the West and maybe lower. I think that Kelly Oubre was kind of an interesting pickup for them in the wake of the Thompson injury. It's kind of a risk-reward thing. He's on an expiring deal. He can shoot a bit. He's shown some ability to play 3-and-D, but trouble is he's not Klay Thompson when it comes to shooting. So, and yeah, I mean, the Wiggins thing as well, I really wanted to see Wiggins play with these guys if they were going to keep him to see how he would kind of fit into that machine. And, you know, now it puts a little bit more on his shoulders, and I'm not 100% sure how that's going to work. But yeah, I mean, I think they're still a playoff team, assuming Steph is back in full strength. You know, I think I like James Wiseman as a draft pick. I wouldn't expect him to carry the team this year, but losing Klay was a massive blow. There's no doubt about it.
John, to swing it back to the Raptors, and like we said, Fred's back. You got the two new free agents. What I'm most interested in, and what I think maybe the more national media might be overlooking, is the expected progression of your young stars. Like, Pascal and OG have not reached their ceiling yet. These are still ascending guys who I hope learned a lot from this last playoff bubble run. Plus, you got the championship experience. And I just wonder if the ceiling for the Raptors could take another step with just the guys you have here getting better, as we'd all hope.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if you use that logic, that, you know, taking the next steps and progression, that the team didn't lose a ton of steps from this
right.
season. When you know, assuming that all comes together, I think Siakam, you know, we saw his struggles in the playoffs and in the bubble. You know, my money's on him to learn from that. I mean, this guy, you know, he really picked up a basketball like a decade ago. His rise has been meteoric, and we know the skill set he has, and I know he's dedicated. So I'll put money on him, and OG Anunoby, same thing. I mean, I think he's going to be motivated too, because he's going to be going into his qualifying option year, probably hit restricted free agency, because the Raptors didn't extend him this year. So, I like those pieces a lot. And I mean, obviously with Fred VanVleet, that's what I meant about, you know, signing that contract at 26. Like, for the Raptors, I mean, some people might think it's a lot of money to pay him, but to get a free agent at 26 to be able to sign that deal, of course you're going to pay him the money. It's not like he's 34. You know, we know what kind of warrior he is, and he's going to pick up more slack from Kyle Lowry because, you know, Kyle's going to be a year older too. So I like the way they look.
I think they're probably essentially in many ways the same team as they were last season with a little less experience.
John, with that being said, with the losses of Ibaka and more so Marc Gasol, because I think he brought a little bit more of the veteran leadership and the I've been there before attitude and that kind of swagger. Do you think not having those two veteran guys around will hurt them? Or do you think that the younger players, because they've been through the ringers of long playoff runs and have now won an NBA championship, that the veteran leadership is really already built in and now they just bring in pieces to surround them and those pieces that they bring in will learn from the guys that have already been there?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the idea. I mean, when, last season coming off the championship, coming into this past season, they lost players, but the young guys were on that championship team. You know, I think that, you know, it's so much cliche to say about culture building and all that kind of thing, but the Raptors really do this kind of right. So I think that, you know, having guys that have been there before, you know, being a year older, going through struggles in the playoffs, you know, and that's the thing. And they're going to have to step up. I think that losing Gasol from just a basketball IQ standpoint is a serious blow, you know, but at the same time, I think his legs might start to be going too. I mean, he's 35 years old, so you got to make a business decision there too. But the IQ that those guys brought to the locker room, it's going to be missed, but I suspect that it's rubbed off on all those guys.
John, thank you very much for your time tonight. Great stuff as always, and we'll chat again very soon, I hope.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Take care.
John Chick from The Score. He's their NBA writer as we took a look around the NBA and all the storylines. And specifically here in Toronto, Andy, it is funny, though, how the reactions to losing Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka was almost as if they had lost Fred VanVleet or Kyle Lowry or Pascal Siakam. I get that they were fan favorites and they were useful pieces, but they certainly weren't core pieces or the be-all and end-all to this roster.
Right. I'm glad you said that, Matt, because especially with the Gasol front, we love the guy, okay? Absolutely. But there were a lot of miles put on there, and it's not like you could necessarily rely on him as a complete player every night, right? So at what point, if you're the Raptors, and I think this might prove longer term to be more of a savvy play by Masai Ujiri. Let's take it back to football. What does Bill Belichick become famous for? You let a guy go a year too soon, then a year too late, right? And you get, even if it's to walk to sign and reallocate those assets, and that might be the case here for the Raptors.
Yeah, I think that this year, the way I kind of look at the way that they've done business this season is, let's get Fred locked up. If we lose, listen, Serge Ibaka is not, he's not young. He's not old, but he's not young.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of miles on his body. And Marc Gasol certainly, like you said, has a lot of miles on his body. But I think that really what happened here was they were looking towards next season's free agent class. Everybody is going, you know, head over heels for Giannis, and that's fine. But there are other pieces that the Raptors can go out and get that will certainly help this team. So I think that the goal was to create as much flexibility from a cap perspective as possible and then figure it out from there, because there are plenty of guys that will come in, and guys may look at this Toronto situation a little bit differently than they have in years past, seeing the core is locked up, seeing that, you know, Kyle Lowry is still playing at a very, very high level. Pascal Siakam and OG Anunoby look like they're going to be stars in this league. So I think that's very important, but not that this is going to be a lost year, because this team's still going to compete, but I think that the look was always to next season and to who they can bring in to really round out the roster.
Yeah, I'm with you. And it's a case where they're still super competitive. And like I said, we hope things go well. Siakam and OG are taking the next step, which might make the Raptors look even more appealing to free agency. We want to see both those guys getting better, keep going and until they hit their prime. And at that point, maybe after this season, they're really ready to hit it. And then you go get, whether it's Giannis or somebody else or a trade, like who saw the Kawhi thing coming with Masai? Who knows what he's doing? So you position yourself there while still being super competitive right now. I think it's the best of both worlds, and it's another. The more I think of it, Matt, the more I like this offseason for the Raptors, even with the departures of Gasol and Ibaka.
Yeah, and we don't know what a guy like Malachi Flynn is going to be coming into this team. That's another guy that might be a very useful piece for them on this team. They have no issue with rolling out three point guards. They played enough with Fred and Kyle on the floor last year, and considering that Fred is probably not coming out of the starting lineup, you're going to need another guard to come in and be impactful, and that's what I expect that Malachi Flynn is going to do for this team. But when we talk about the development of Pascal Siakam, when we talk about the development of OG Anunoby and even Fred VanVleet, what indication have we been given to tell us that those guys aren't going to get better again? There's been literally no indication that that's going to happen. So the expectation is that next season, by the end of the year, all hoping that, you know, health is good and everything goes to plan, is that these guys are going to be even better than what we've seen. That's the piece of information that people are overlooking. This team has the potential to be great, and those guys are going to be the key factor in all of that.
Yep, 100% with you, man. This is a team and a franchise positioned to make multiple runs. Rest of the East is real good. Don't get me wrong. We know this isn't going to be easy, right? It's not going to be easy at all. But there's not that team. Like, Matt, there's not the LeBron with the Cavs. There's not the Golden State Warriors at full strength where you just had to cross your fingers. You could avoid them for as long as possible. There's not that surefire out. You can pick some flaws with each of the upper echelon teams, some more than others. But the Raptors, whether it's this year or next year, they land the right piece, man. We could be talking about more parades. Like, let's go.
Well, not only that, but everybody wants to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks. And we do have to hit a break here, so I'll make this very quick. But everybody wants to talk about the Milwaukee Bucks, like they're this juggernaut. The Milwaukee Bucks haven't won squat. So let's before we put the cart before the horse here, let's just wait and see what they do, because that team still has to come together and prove something. We're running late here, but when we come back, best in show, we're going to bring on producer Sho Ali, and he's going to grill us with some questions for a change instead of us grilling somebody else. That's all coming up on Sportsnet tonight here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, and alongside me, my co-host, Andy McNamara. And joining us for his usual partaking of the show near this time is our producer, Sho Ali, with Best in Show. So, how did we do tonight, Sho?
Yeah, good stuff tonight, guys. I like it. It's been flowing well. Just a couple more minutes to go on the program. But, no, good stuff from you guys tonight.
Thank you. And now it's your turn to shine. So what do you got for us tonight?
All right, so I had seen some of these kinds of sentiments being kicked around Twitter, and I thought you guys would be a good pair to ask this to. So I forget who exactly had said this, but it was a topic about who is a player that is super underrated / who does not get enough love, right? And this particular person was being asked about Keenan Allen, who is a Chargers wide receiver, for those who are not aware. But if we expanded this to perhaps all sports, I remember I had asked some of our coworkers this earlier in the week, so I'm curious what you guys think. If you expand this to all sports, is there a name that jumps out to you guys? And Matt, maybe we can start with you, about a player who is super underrated or who doesn't get enough love, perhaps.
Ooh, that's a tough one, because I think there's plenty of guys that are out there that don't get enough love, but I'm gonna go with hockey, and I'm going to talk about Alexander Barkov. Okay. He plays in a terrible market in Florida. He's certainly underappreciated. If if Sasha Barkov was playing for the New York Rangers or the Toronto, well, the Toronto Maple Leafs would be a no-brainer, but even the Chicago Blackhawks or Boston Bruins, he would be absolutely a household name and be looked at as one of the best players in the NHL because he can score, he can dish the puck, but not only that, he's also a really good defensive player. So I look at Sasha Barkov as a guy who is so underappreciated. And when his contract's up, if the Florida Panthers don't lock him up to an extension, his market is going to be absolutely massive, and he's going to make big, big money.
I like that. I like that one. For me, I'm going to go with Kareem Hunt. Of my Browns.
I'm stunned that Andy went with the Browns.
But I'll tell you why, guys. I'll tell you why. Because with Kareem Hunt, former NFL rushing champ, right, had some trouble, got suspended, paid his price, and came back. And the selflessness that him and Nick Chubb share in that backfield has been remarkable. But more importantly, from the football side, I don't think people are giving this guy enough credit because the shine goes to Chubb, obviously, and the defense and the record right now. But when you look at what Kareem Hunt was able to do, 100-yard rushing game 2 weeks ago, he's got 4 rushing touchdowns. He has multiple passing touchdowns. He is the hurdle into the end zone last week. The push, he'll go also, if there's no fullback, he'll become the fullback for Nick Chubb. He's selfless, team guy, but more importantly, he produces and puts up big numbers, both in real life and fantasy football. So I think Kareem Hunt, it maybe gets a little overshadowed, but that dude is legit.
Andy, is Kareem going to be on the Browns for many more seasons, or do you think he takes a starting job somewhere?
He got re-upped for 2 more years, so he'll be here for 2 more. And okay. Then, you know, then at that point, I think would probably be in the 28, 29 range, so then just sort of reassess. But he re-upped. He's from the Cleveland area. From Akron, I believe, just outside. So he took the hometown discount. It's like, hey, man, you know what? You guys gave me my shot when no one else wanted me, so I'm staying. So, heck.
Oh, show. There have been some very shocking things on our show tonight. This had to be the most shocking.
Oh, yeah. Andy picking up Cleveland Brown as an underrated
Hunt,
player.
Baby. Yeah.
Kareem. I like. Show. Who's your most underrated?
Oh, mine. You know what? That's a tough one, actually. Probably somebody in hockey as well, I'd probably go with, right? Like, I know. Like, I like yours of Sasha Barkov. You know, I don't know. You guys tell me, actually. Is Mikhail Sergachev, I just thinking of him because he signed the contract extension. Is he underrated, you think, or is he properly rated?
I think he's a little underrated because he gets a little overshadowed by Victor Hedman on that Tampa Bay team because Victor Hedman's so good. And you know what? Honestly, like, I actually think that Victor Hedman's a little bit underrated because I don't think people know how good this guy actually is, which is crazy to say because, again, playing in that Florida market, not a lot of people watch those games despite how good the Tampa Bay Lightning are. We saw it in the Stanley Cup final and throughout the playoffs. This guy's a beast.
He won the Conn Smythe this year, right?
Yes.
He did, right? Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
I think... So what else you got for us, show?
Yeah, for sure. I also asked this question earlier in the week, and I'm curious as to what your guys' answers are, because everyone always has a different answer to this, and I had seen this. This had come to my attention first from our coworker, colleague, friend, Mark Boffo, okay? Boffo had tweeted about this. And it was like this Twitter question that had been going around, and it was simply, what is the best fake song, right? And I guess the rules were, it has to be a song that exists in the world of a show or a movie first, but not our world, right? So I'd asked this to Gunning and McKee on Monday, so I'm curious as to what you guys think. And my pick, for example, was, to let you guys think about it, and Andy, maybe we can start with you, since I started with Matt last time. Mine was, if you guys remember from the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou with George Clooney, and they sing that song I'm a Man of Constant Sorrow by the Foggy Bottom Boys. So that's an example, right, of one. A fake song that exists in the world of a short movie, not our world, but it's still a really good song. So Andy, do you have one that comes to mind?
So like one that wasn't released out, like I Believe I Can Fly was out with R. Kelly, and then it was with in Space Jam. So not like that, but it was like created in the movie for the movie type of thing.
Yeah, like it could still have played like on the radio, for example, but it was created within the world of a movie. Like an example that, for example, Sam used was The Shallows from A Star Is Born.
Oh boy. You know what, guys?
That's a good
one. I got nothing. I'm sorry, Sean. I don't got nothing for you, brother. I don't know. I can't think of one. I'm sorry.
I was having a hard time thinking of one, and then one came to mind that ended up being a really good song. It's certainly inappropriate to be aired on the radio, but ended up being a really, really, I thought it was great, was Scotty Doesn't Know from Eurotrip.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That is
just such a good song, and it's funny because there's a guy that used to work for my dad who's a friend of my cousin's, who he might even be listening now because he's that crazy, but his name is Scotty, and we used to always skate, yeah, Scotty doesn't know. Scotty doesn't know. So that's where it kind of emerged from. But that movie in itself is a very underrated, funny movie. And that song was such a great jam from there. I love it.
There's also, if you guys remember, there's that movie with Tom Hanks, which I believe Hanks himself did actually direct this movie. I think it was called That Thing You Do. And there was, I think this song might have actually just been called That Thing You Do. And that was a pretty good one. And also another honorable mention maybe is from The Wedding Singer. If you remember, Adam Sandler sings the song, and I'm pretty sure it's called Somebody Kill Me. And I think he sings it and he wrote it as well.
Yes,
you guys remember that one.
Yes.
Oh, That Thing That You Do, that's great. A great throwback. That was based on like the sort of the 60s like boy band type of thing.
Yes. Right.
And I think it actually, after the movie got out, I don't think it hit number one, but it actually did pretty well.
The song, yeah. I think the song got, I don't know if it won, you're right. I don't know if it won anything like that, but it definitely got nominated for like an Oscar and Golden Globes and stuff like that. But yeah, I thought that was a fun topic. And if you think any more, we can always come back to that. But we'll move out of those things for now. Have you guys ever heard of the book or movie adaptation of this book, perhaps? It's called Ready Player One. Either of you?
Yes. Yes.
The name sounds familiar. I couldn't tell you what it's about.
Okay, so...
I liked the movie. It's a good movie.
And so have you read the book, Matt?
No, that would require way too much of my time. I stopped reading books and got a lot dumber, which is probably why I didn't beat you in that trivia earlier today.
Okay, no, I only asked because in the movie it was a passable adaptation of the book, certainly, and it's basically the same kind of thing. This kid knows everything there is to know about pop culture in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and he basically uses that knowledge for the book and the movie to save the world, get the girl, becomes absurdly rich. It's basically like the book is essentially, and again, the movie is too, it's essentially like a nerd wish fulfillment book, right? To describe it in short. And they're actually coming out with a sequel. The authors are writing a sequel. Ready Player 2 is the name of the book. Ernest Cline, I believe, is the author's name. And the prologue had been put out on the publisher's website. And it's kind of like more of the same. Like, if you did not like the first one, you will not like the second one. And it basically has gotten a lot of people making fun of it, even though there are a subsection of people, I think, that do really like this kind of thing, like wish fulfillment type stuff. So my question to you guys is, what is something you love that a lot of people hate? So, okay, something you love that a lot of other people really dislike. And just for the sake of our conversation, we'll leave sports out of it. Just so Andy can't say, like, the Cleveland Browns or something like that, right? Yeah. We'll leave sports completely out of it. So something you love that a lot of people hate. Matt, maybe we can start with you since we went with Andy last time.
I was gonna say me, but I don't know if that's possible because I'm sure there's enough people that hate me, and I know I sure love myself. I would say, and a lot of people might not know this, but because of where I grew up, it was a big staple for us, especially in more so in high school. But country music, man, I'm
really?
A big fan of country music. Yeah, I really like it. Yeah, and listen, I grew up in small town Ontario. That sounds like I grew up in, you know, the sticks, so far away from civility and and normalcy. But, you know, I grew up near farming towns, and we had, you know, the Munenori Kawasaki's rendition of Bush parties. Those were actually a thing, and we literally used to sit out in a farmer's field and drink beer and whatever and blast country music and sit by a bonfire. Like, that's things that we did. So I know a lot of people don't like country music, but I'm actually a big fan, and I'll listen to it whenever I can.
All right. I got one, and it's might be a little weird. It's a food one. And if it rarely comes up in conversation, but if it does, people think something's not right about you, Andy. I like eating.
If you say ketchup on steak, we're going to have a problem.
No. dill pickles. Just eat them. Put three in a bowl. Watch some TV. Eat. Just have a fork. Eat some dill pickles. They're delicious. You get the full ones. You snack on it. It's phenomenal. I love dill pickles straight, and people are like, what happened to you?
I don't even think that's a hot take or anything. I'm in the same boat. I didn't think that people thought that that was weird or hated that. I love dill pickles.
Wow, look at that. Look at you guys.
All right. It's like, so do you have it on, are you eating a sandwich with? I'm like, no, I get a jar of dill pickles. I pick three out, no more than three, put it in a bowl and eat it.
Yeah,
that's an evening.
I'm in.
Matt, I swear to you, upon all that is holy, mine is and was going to be until and it, even after you said that, mine is I love ketchup on steak. Oh my god!
It doesn't
matter what rarity of it is. It is like I do like my steaks quite rare, but like slather it in ketchup, please.
Wow. Oh my god! I think I just hurled.
Oh, like proper chefs, like fancy restaurants, just like. You swine. They just like turn their nose up at you like,
my cousin is a chef, and he would absolutely lose his mind at that take. That is absolutely wrong.
like she'll just make direct eye contact with the chef whilst using all the ketchup. Just,
do you have any ketchup right with this? Yeah.
It's like, oh my god. Is there more?
You wanna see a chef have a heart attack? Do that.
she'll kill the guy.
Too good. Okay, you know what? We'll finish on this one, boys. This is a purely selfish question because I've been waffling on this decision all week. So hopefully you two can help me out with this. I have lasted this long in the Sportsnet Survivor pool, and there are only about 40 people or so left. Which I'm one of those people. Like, somehow, I don't know, but I'm thinking of going with either the Giants against the awful Cincinnati Bengals, who are now without Joe Burrow, or I'm thinking of going with the Cincinnati Browns against Cleveland Browns.
Hey, don't move my team again, show.
I'm sorry, Andy. I'm sorry.
Don't move him again.
the Giants against the Bengals or the Browns over the Jacksonville Jaguars. So I believe, Andy, are starting Mike Glennon, I want to say.
Yes, they are. They're dusting off old Mike Glennon, who hasn't made a start since 2017, who is like, if you picture the 6'7", elongated throw, just like a pass rusher's dream to sack. I'd say, you know, honestly, Joe, I think you're going to be good either way. I really like the Giants versus Brandon Allen. Ryan Finley got passed. They're just like, nope, they got right over him. I'm going to say Browns for the Jags, and not just because they're my team, but because of a couple different reasons. The main thing is, like, people rag on Baker Mayfield. If this is ever a game to get right, the Jaguars have the fewest sacks in the NFL. They have 9 total. It's the least by a long shot. They're clearly playing out the stretch. There's nothing to play for. You got Mike Glennon. The only player you got to worry about really is James Robinson. You just got to get to... Oh, and they're missing their top pass rusher because of COVID. So, and their kicker. They got a backup kicker. I think you take the Browns.
Yeah, I'm of the same opinion, but I'm gonna go kind of a different way. Well, sort of the same direction, but in a different way. I'm gonna make a right instead of a left here, and that is just that the Jags secondary basically has like 100 guys out. They thought about calling me, but then realized how out of shape I am. Like, that's where they're at right now with guys in their secondary. They're just so banged up. Like Andy said, they're starting Mike Glennon. And Mike Glennon is a joke of an NFL. Imagine that guy got a double-digit million-dollar contract from the Chicago Bears. Like, what it's a disaster. Yeah, it's an awful place to be.
What a country.
Yeah. And I look at the opportunity for the Giants is a good one, but weird stuff happens like that. I don't think anything weird is happening. I think that in this situation, you take the team that is the favorite, that is the better team, and that's the Browns. The Jags also don't really have a good run defense, and as we know, the Cleveland Browns run the ball really well, and they'll throw a bit in the first half and then just run the ball down their throats. I think that is, I would go with the Browns as well. I just think that's way too easy to pass up here.
All right, I like it. I think you guys have convinced me. I was honestly leaning Giants, but I think you've both talked me into the Cleveland Browns. Thank you.
I think who has the bigger bust potential, Baker Mayfield or Daniel Jones? And I think the answer is Daniel Jones, as much as Baker Mayfield's kind of been a little wishy-washy for anybody, really.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
All right. Show,
lock him in.
Great stuff as always. Very good job booking the show tonight. And thanks for doing this. Appreciate it, buddy.
Good stuff, guys.
All right. So Andy and I will be back after this to wrap things up here on Sportsnet tonight. You're listening on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Sportsnet tonight here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Marchese, and alongside me, Andy McNamara. And Andy, as we finish off another episode of this fine program, our second time working together this week, I wanted to, of course, look at one NFL story that we kind of covered a little bit today, but we didn't really get too much into it, and we've got a couple minutes here, so I figured they do deserve a little bit of chatter on this show, and that's the Houston Texans. Ever since the firing of Bill O'Brien, which happened probably 3 weeks too late, they've actually been very competitive. They beat the Patriots last week. They win this week in Deshaun Watson's first ever Thanksgiving Day start. He was really good, over 300 yards, four touchdown passes. Will Fuller was really good. Brandon Cooks was solid. And we saw Duke Johnson make a great catch for a touchdown. It is amazing to see what a head coach can do, or good or bad, on a football team. We've seen what happens with the Jets, but Bill O'Brien's issues that he brought along to this team were very evident. The team had to make a change. I feel like he already screwed them up enough when, you know, he got rid of DeAndre Hopkins. So, you know, you look at what this team has done, and they've been really, really good since Romeo Crennel has taken over, and Deshaun Watson has been the biggest benefactor in all of this.
Well, the thing is, like, for Bill O'Brien, with the draft, it's just the whole, like, decent head coach, but we see it so often, guys get power hungry, they grab, and horrible, horrible GM. You've hosed this team for the next 2 years. As far as rebuilding and retooling and whatever the case might be to go through the draft. But yeah, you look at Deshaun Watson and how he's really been able to do all this without much of a running game at all. Like, David Johnson was good before he got injured. Duke Johnson is he's a third down back. That guy cannot rush in between the tackles. He averages less than 3 yards a carry. That's just who he is. So to see what he's been able to do, And really be able to build and even be able to sprinkle the ball around to guys like Jordan Akins and Darren Fells, more under the radar guys, but spread it around and really become the top rusher himself. I think it's remarkable. I just hope for a guy with that talent, you find a way. You find the right head coach, and then you find a way to get right. I think the defense needs, like, we love J.J. Watt, had a little pick six, but he's getting long in the tooth. You got to start revamping that D. And if you can do that, Matt, maybe pump up that running game a bit, the Texans will be right back in it. But there's a lot to overcome.
Yeah, and it does kind of feel as if Deshaun Watson's in a little bit of a no-win situation here just because of of that defense that's around him. Yes, they got a playoff win last year against the Bills. They in reality, Andy, they probably shouldn't have won that game. The Bills had control of it and kind of pissed it away. But Deshaun Watson, in doing my research for my article this week for Sportsnet.ca, Deshaun Watson through the first four games of the season was QB 13, I believe he was. So in most leagues, he was a QB 2. He had never finished lower than a QB 5 in the two full seasons that he had played before, because obviously we know his rookie year, he got hurt. After those first 4 weeks, he was QB 4. This is the type of impact that it's had not having Bill O'Brien around. And I remember reading about a potential mutiny that was happening with the players and O'Brien. And honestly, Andy, I feel like that's exactly what happened, because we have seen a totally different Texans team.
Well, and think about it. Since week four, he's thrown two interceptions. That's it. Like the turnovers way down. 20 touchdowns to 5 interceptions on the year. Big yardage. And now it's a case where you're not going to fall into the trap necessarily. And players never buy into that. People say, oh, the tank for the draft pick. If you're on a team, you don't care about the draft, because they could draft the guy who takes your job. But for the Texans, they don't have that to worry about, the first round pick. So they're going to try to win as many games as possible. You have Romeo Crennel should not be the full-time head coach going forward. He's proven in the past it's not his bag. It's not his strength. However, is he a heck of a defensive coordinator? Yes, and should probably be an associate head coach if you bring in, let's say, a young hotshot offensive-minded guy. Sure. Matt, I think you need a young creative coach who has fresh offensive thoughts, who can motivate, and then you have sort of Romeo there as the godfather, kind of looking over things and making sure everything is done correctly. Because he got so much there on that team.
Romeo Crennel as the wartime consigliere. I like it.
Yes, exactly. Well said, exactly.
Andy, this has been a lot of fun, as always. Great job tonight, and thanks for keeping me afloat here, pal. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you too, brother. Always fun.
All right. That's going to be it for us tonight. For Andy McNamara, for producer Shoal Lee, for technical operator Tom Young, I'm Matt Marchese. You've been listening to Sportsnet Tonight here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.